Here we have a potential opportunity to remove a measure for the sake of parsimony. We have two related to alcohol and drug first treatment, and then screening and referral for treatment. Both of these, I think, were under consideration in the Medicaid adult core set, and the alcohol dependence, the ESPRT measure was removed for overlapping topic reasons. We were wondering if this group felt as if those were two independent issues and we wanted to keep both measures, or if they're related enough that this was an opportunity. And I see our subject matter experts springing to action to weigh in. Rita, go ahead.
I would make the comment that these are different types of measures. The first one, initiation and engagement, is once you've identified somebody with substance abuse, do they get engaged in treatment? And so that's a, once diagnosed, do they get engaged with treatment? Because it's a horrendously difficult and often a linkage is not made. The alcohol misuse is actually not for those diagnosed with alcoholism, but actually for those engaged in risky drinking. And therefore, as some of you all may know, the national coverage determination unit that CMS runs recently released approval for alcohol misuse screening referral to treatment as a measure that falls under the ACA's prevention services. So it's been endorsed by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, but it is for risky drinking, and the other measure is for those with a diagnosis of substance abuse. So I see them really as quite different.
I would agree that they're different populations. I'd clarify, though, that the screening measure is for the entire spectrum, those who are engaged in risky drinking as well as those who might meet criteria for dependence. The problem with the HEDIS measures is that they're very well recognized and have been endorsed all over the place. The evidence that they're tightly linked with outcome is very sparse. And so that's a concern. With the ESPRT measure, the problem is in the specifications. And it, at least in our system in VA, we have a lot of concerns about one that's based on those who screen positive then being in the denominator for the follow-up measure because it disincentivizes effective screening practices. You can kind of steer your denominator to those who are already most likely to be recognized and get some services. So a population-based measure, what percentage of all your people are actually getting some attention, some documented follow-up for alcohol misuse or related problems, is much more comprehensive and seems to incentivize appropriate screening and follow-up practices. But that isn't played out yet. There's not yet consensus on those specifications, so I'm not sure how the process can go forward given that lack of information.
There is an ongoing behavioral health endorsement project at NQF now, and I believe they're considering alcohol use measures. So we can use both of these as illustrations. I think I'm welcome to someone disagreeing that we should keep them, but they would be both on the table with certain caveats about everything Dan has just raised and others.
I guess I'd strongly endorse the concept for mm-hmm. both measures, but
with
still some details
caution.
To work out. Yeah.
Rhonda?
Yeah, I just want to add that besides NQF looking at this, NCQA has reconstituted their BMAP, and so they'll be looking at this also. Because those measures are measuring very low, and they haven't changed at all, so there's some issues with it.
That's really useful. I think we'll move on keeping both measures then. Okay. The next measures are on pages 5 and 6. These are around readmissions. We had selected one sort of based on a spreadsheet like this that says all-cause readmission index risk-adjusted, and that sounded like exactly what we wanted. This measure recently failed its endorsement maintenance and didn't account for comorbidity in its risk adjustment model, so we're recommending that it be removed. Again, there's an ongoing endorsement project considering other readmissions measures. So there's two that have been moving forward. A primary difference between them is a health plan level of analysis or a hospital level of analysis. And so potentially the indication here is that these measures both have merits pending the conclusion of the endorsement process. It might be premature for us to recommend one over another at this point. But they are stronger than the measure we had previously been considering. Okay. Any comments on readmissions? Leo?
Just a really quick question. So am I understanding then that sort of the option of taking the measure with a required modification is not on the table in this kind of circumstance? I mean, if there's only one problem with it, are we better scrapping it for another measure, or are we better saying this measure but with, you know, one key, you know, risk adjusted?
These are really complex measures. Just kind of doing one little tweak to them doesn't really work, I think, and the process is still playing its way out, and I think at the end of it we'll have probably a health plan level and a hospital level measure. It's premature to say exactly what it'll be, but clearly the two that are at least have been approved by the steering committee are both very well risk-adjusted and are attempting to harmonize with each other so that the health plan measure and the hospital let measure would be aligned. Not clear exactly what will happen with the other measure.
Thanks.
Adam?
Just to address the question you posed, does all-cause readmission have more to do with community-level factors than the quality of hospital care? I think it has to do with the quality of the communication and collaboration between the hospital and those community-based support services and care providers. So, you know, getting back to that question of the unit of accountability, what is the appropriate unit of accountability for kinds of populations we see in the dual eligible group? You know, it's really both. And I don't think you can isolate one. I mean, a health plan obviously has responsibility across the continuum, but where there's not actually a health plan assuming responsibility, you know, there still, I think, needs to be some measure of accountability among the different partners in the care of the dually eligible.
Thank you. Laura?
This is an extremely important measure to CMS. We have been mandated to, I'm sure everyone who does Medicare, a quality improvement project just on readmission. And they're using the all-cause readmission, the current rate, for the measurement. So we are required to use, and we are starting with our baseline this year. It's also one of the STAR measures, and they're using this current measure. So good or bad, they're using it right now. It's also important, the state of California has recently mandated that we do an all statewide collaborative effort to reduce readmissions again. So it's the state of California has also taken it on. So I'm getting hit from both sides on this, on the readmissions and the accountability. They're clearly placing with the health plan to figure it out. How, what the measure is going to be, I guess Cheryl will have to figure that out. So, but I think they are kind of looking to the health plans where they exist to figure that out. So I think this is a measure that's going to have to stay, and it's very important to SNP measures.
Steve.
I guess I won't take a lot of time, as I just want to echo what has been just said there. I think, yes, of course, it involves a lot of the community-level factors, and that's just the point. We're being asked to identify connectedness measures, and what more, you know, does this require connectedness? I think in the interest of achieving a person's health care goals,
and duals are especially, you know, adverse to issues around those kind of transitions. So, and eventually the accountability should be at an ACO level or something. I haven't seen anything drive the health system to start to work together more than this readmission issue. And so I think it would be a mistake not to keep it in there. I'm not sure I fully understand the other alternative measures, but those are my thoughts.
Do you need me to go over that again, the difference between the...
Carol, can we just, like, keep to the concept level for this one and say we are sure that we are going to want to measure readmits, but, you know, we have to wait for the process?
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I was going to highlight with this area and a few others that we've talked on, specifically this area, one of the exercises I was doing just last week was looking at every readmissions measure I could find and looking at the specs for, like, literally diving into the minute details on the specs for each one to figure out exactly what is being reported on the denominator and the numerator. And so I'm thinking about that in the context of our demonstrations to figure out how we would apply it. But it also was that sort of the concept level, looking at what's in exactly each measure, whether it's a health plan measure, hospital measure, whether it's the all cause or different types of readmission, and then thinking about what makes sense as far as a measure for our area. So I think sticking at that, and clearly if something exists but then gets improved or changed or replaced with something else, we would look to the one that was likely, you know, look at what the changes are, but look at what's likely to be the one that's being used more in the future, as opposed to just sticking with one particular measure that was cited. I've written too many regs in the past to know you have to allow for a future improvement to fit into the reg because it's tough to rewrite. So we will be doing that. But this is one area that was sort of the exercise that I was doing with this, and likely what we would do with others as well. So I think sticking at the concept, we know there are multiple, and anything specific to the concept that we should look at, that this group feels strongly about, too.
Okay, so if any of you have a comment relative to that very last point of Cheryl's, anything that you absolutely would want considered in the all-cause readmission measure, you may speak, and otherwise we must move on. Jenny.
It's more of a question as a follow-up because I know that CMS is working on work that's on the multiple chronic conditions itself, and I know NQF is doing some work on that. So how does that work potentially inform this particular matter, because it is the comorbidity factor that's in play?
And that's the tricky part. We try to pull in all of the information we have from every set, and literally, or where as information is coming in, there's information that comes in to Karen through Medicaid, through her expert panel, through the work that we're doing with the MAP, through other work that CMS is doing. There's also the work on the health plan side and the Medicare health plan side. And we literally get all of the people in the same room, and we go through where we are, the input from each of those, and try to figure out how it applies best in this particular situation. So all of the information that is provided into this group goes into that as well and informs that. But we bring together all of the different perspectives and the different areas and ways that CMS measures and the different input that's coming in through each of those ways to try to sit down and figure out the best way to incorporate it for the dual population. And it's, you know, clearly in the very beginning, but that, and it's tough to get your arms around all of that, but it is what we're trying to do, and all of your perspectives are taken into consideration with that as well.
Hey. Everybody? Trish,
one last thing? Yeah, one thing that I thought there were places on the materials that we had for today, but I couldn't find them on a quick relook that incorporated the concerns that I raise at every meeting about observation status when you're looking at readmissions. So I would say that absolutely that is one thing that should be incorporated into the thinking of what you're measuring and what should go into that, because we have considerable experience knowing that people are in hospitals for many days looking so much like inpatients, but they are not called inpatients, and they generally fall outside of the measuring tools. So I would urge you to bring that into the measure concept.
Thank you. We have three slides that we're going to have to skip for now, and we hope to revisit them at the end of the day, and that is around unintended consequences of measures, measure modifications, and measure gaps, all rich areas, and so we hope you save some brain power for the end of the day, but we have guest presenters with other commitments today, and we don't want to get too much farther behind schedule. So thank you for bearing with us on that. We do quickly need to pause for public comment on anything from this morning. So, Alice, if you'd like to.
So, Nicole, can you give instructions about how, if any of the members of the public want to give a comment, they could indicate that to you?
Certainly. For public comment, ladies and gentlemen, please press star 1 at this time. We have no public comment at this time.
Anybody in the room want to give a comment? Nope. Okay, great. Next we'll welcome Karen up to the table, please. Karen Yanos is a technical director in the Division of Quality Evaluation and Health Outcomes at CMS and a former colleague of mine from CHCS, and so welcome, Karen.
Hi, everyone. I'm so glad I got to be here for the morning conversation because it really helped me kind of tweak what I'm about to comment on. And certainly hearing a lot of the, I guess, unofficial angst that you're dealing with, I can certainly relate because that was exactly how what I've been doing for the past year. And Alice knows that because she participated in our subcommittee to the National Evaluation, National Committee this spring. So I'm here to tell you about an aligning or parallel process that's going on in the Medicaid side. We were directed by the Affordable Care Act to identify an initial core set of healthcare quality measures that were applicable to Medicaid-eligible adults. So it's a broad provision that really signifies to us and to Medicaid the first time where we're able to kind of put teeth around what we want to do, which is standardize a starting point to look at standardized quality reporting metrics for Medicaid programs. So there's lots of caveats with this program versus a lot of the programs that Jordan talked about, which are on the Medicare side. There's no payment involved. It's a voluntary program. The target audience are state Medicaid agencies, so that's really who we were trying to target. They would be the ones who would be voluntarily collecting and reporting the initial core set of measures and submitting them to CMS starting in December of 2013. So just to kind of take a step back, the target population, it's Medicaid-eligible adults 18 and over, so it's very broad. We're talking about women who may be pregnant, adult preventive care, and obviously the dual eligibles would also fall into this area. Our goal was to have a manageable set of quality metrics that would really resonate with our state Medicaid partners, understanding that there are multiple reporting burdens already, that states vary in how they are sophisticated in terms of electronic health records, the data that they have access to, and their ability to add one more measure in certain cases. So we certainly had the word parsimonious in mind, but also wanted to get to a really good starting point in terms of Medicaid healthcare quality measures. We worked with our colleagues at the Healthcare Research and Quality Agency. I'm sure I messed that up, as I usually do. And with their subcommittee to their national committee. So it was, for intents and purposes, a TEP that really had Medicaid agency representatives, healthcare quality measurement experts as well. We looked at, and I think I went through some of this in July, looked at a list of 1,000 measures that were currently being used, and that was the other piece that the legislation gave us in terms of focus. The measures had to be currently in use, so we couldn't tweak or modify. That would come in a future date, so we had to kind of pick measures that were ready for prime time, so that could be collected by state Medicaid agencies starting tomorrow if need be. So when I last left you all, we had a list of 51 measures and had put them through public comment and got about 100 public comments back and sifted through them. I'm sure you won't be surprised because I'm sure it's a lot of what some of your public comments were. The biggest one was 51 is too many measures for us to collect. Please decrease. You can decrease by aligning to the extent possible to programs that are already in place, like meaningful use, or physician quality reporting where there's payment attached to it. If there's other measures that other groups are doing, please align to the extent possible with that. The other piece I think you'll find interesting is the course that the 51 draft set was too burdensome from a data collection perspective. So when you're thinking about kind of how to narrow down or pare down, the biggest piece that we took away was administrative claims versus hybrid methodology versus medical record review. And there were very specific comments on these cannot be collected as currently specified by all Medicaid agencies. So we really wanted to keep an eye on that. Other ways that folks suggested to limit the set was only select NQF-endorsed measures, only select HEDIS measures, only select measures that we're already using, as I mentioned before. Through public comment, there was also about 50 measures that were posted, so we also looked at that as well. So when we convened our National Advisory Committee again, we have this giant handy-dandy measurement book that really has each of the measures, the 51 measures, as well as everything that came through public comment. And we looked at kind of how this could align with our measurement selection criteria, which I think is the next slide. So the evaluation criteria that you see there, it's importance. So how is this important? How is this issue representative of a Medicaid population and the importance of it? So prevalence rates would come into play, financial importance, opportunity for improvement, and measurement performance rates if they were available. So the second one was scientific evidence that supported the measure. Now, this wasn't always there in certain measures, but we at least wanted to look at how this measure addressed the chronic condition or the particular condition that it was looking at. So if there was a clinical guideline that was attached to it, that would be in the documentation as well. Scientific soundness of the measure, the last two, alignment with federal programs I mentioned, that were one of the pieces that came through public comment. And the last one, feasibility for state reporting, I have to say really was kind of the undertone of the entire group as they looked through all of these. They really wanted to make sure that they were not just kind of reach illustrative measures, but measures that would be, like I said, they would resonate with our state Medicaid partners since they're a voluntary program. The way that we organized our kind of paring down process was to break down into different groups that were representative of the Medicaid adult population. So we had a maternity reproductive health group. Medicaid pays for 40% of all births in the country. Certainly wanted to give attention to that area. There was a mental health substance use group, an adult preventive care group, and then the complex health care needs group that really kind of tied all of the really complex issues that Alice was a part of. So this is where we really wanted the folks to look at a subset of the 51 measures and really dig down into the technical specifications of its exclusions, numerous denominators, to make sure that measures that they would recommend to the broader group to look at were really representative of someone with developmental disabilities or chronic conditions or applicable to the dual-eligible population. So in your packets, you'll have our final list of 26 measures. I think the important thing to take away from there is it's parsimonious, and we went for breadth versus depth, and we kind of had to because our target population was so broad. So really trying to make sure that we captured a little bit of everything, kind of what some folks were saying this morning, with an eye to other areas that we want to address through our measurement gap development process. So a couple things that I think I thought would be helpful to give you as examples in terms of the types of thought process and discussion points that the complex healthcare needs subgroup thought about, and they're illustrated by those 2 points. So data collection was one of the biggest areas, as I mentioned before, and so was how applicable is this for a Medicaid program at large. So our intent is that our initial core set would be taken, hopefully in whole, by a Medicaid agency and be used to see how they are working as a purchaser to improve quality overall for the Medicaid population. So I'll give you 3 examples of 3 types of measures that we looked at in this subgroup that I think will probably resonate the most. The first one was the care transition, the 048-648. And I know that was one of the ones that you discussed this morning. So this is the record transition, not the elements part. Both of those measures were in our 51 list. The biggest piece of feedback was their electronically health record-derived measures. You're going to be asking a lot for states to collect this. So it was actually not voted in majority, but as CMS looked at it, we really wanted to include this in there as one of the reach measures. So an understanding that not all states would select this measure, but also knowing that in lieu of anything that could come to this area or that could address something as important as care transition, we would want to have it there and really work with our state partners to support the collection of this measure. The second one is the preventive quality indicators, which I think may also have been as part of your discussions. So several of them, the PQI for urinary tract infection, for pneumonia, and for dehydration were ones that really resonated with the complex healthcare needs group. However, upon further review, the exclusions actually do not include the dual eligible population. So we kind of had to put that off to the side and put that in as one of the areas that we would want to keep the concept of, but really try to see how we could work with the measurement developer or with other contractors to understand how we could use that for the dual eligible population or folks with multiple chronic conditions. The third measure that I wanted to highlight was the a lot of discussion this morning was on the CAHPS survey. One of the items that we selected for our 26 measures is the supplemental questions for the Adult Medicaid CAHPS Survey 4.0. And really wanted to see how we could kind of get the most bang for our buck in terms of the collection that we would require of states. And the CAHPS supplemental questions look at care coordination, shared decision-making, and health promotion and education. So, again, knowing that this would only be the survey would only be done, I think, every year, hopefully, that it would get to some of the other questions. So rather than select, I don't know, X number of measures that would touch upon all those, the state would collect one CAHPS survey with the supplemental questions that could give you more information on your target population. The other piece more broadly is there was a lot of concepts for measurement availability. I mean, that was really a second thing that we had with this population, is we knew what conceptually should be there in measurement. Unfortunately, the measurement field wasn't there. But I think that's really where this process is really going to inform our work, our future work. You know, areas like Alzheimer's disease, dementia, dual diagnoses. These were all issues that came up that we all know are valid and critical issues in terms of measurement for the Medicaid population, but just couldn't find measures that were, as currently specified, applicable or that could be easily collected by state Medicaid programs. So in terms of gaps, what we really want to be able to do in the next 12 months is we are actually legislatively required to roll out an adult quality measures program. And the central goal of this program is to develop measures where there are gap areas in the core set. Because we are, starting in 2015, required to start updating the initial core set every year. So in order to really understand, we have to kind of take a step back, really push out the technical specifications for the 26 measures, which we'll be doing in the fall, and then working with states to understand how they can collect these measures, why these measures are important, how they can use the data to kind of tell the story of their quality program and use it to drive quality improvement. I will tell you that leading up to this, ramp up of the technical assistance program is we will be working with HRQ to help us understand how we can take these 26 measures and potentially do stratification or additional guidance for reporting to really get to some of those racial and economic disparities, as well as some of the issues on how we can use those measures for a dual eligible population. So the good thing is we've done this for the kids' initial core set measures, but we didn't have time to think about how to help states implement the measures through the Affordable Care Act. We're actually given an extra year, and we plan to use this year to really kind of drill down on these 26 measures and try to figure out how much guidance for reporting, in addition to the technical specifications, we can give our states so they know that you can use one measure, you can use them in this way, and you can slice and dice them, hopefully, to tell you kind of a broader picture of your Medicaid eligible population. I guess we'll be doing measurement development as well. I think Jordan was talking about a magic pot of money. We actually have a small magic pot of money that would for this adult quality measures program. So the pot of money has to be distributed equally across our target population, so 18 and over Medicaid eligible adults. But we know this is one of the biggest gap areas. And I would just urge that the more detail that you can provide us in terms of the types of modifications to a particular measure or the types of areas that need further development would really be helpful so that we can then take that and put it into our measurement development work as well.
Great. Thank you, Karen.
Sure. I think the next slide has the discussion questions. So I think as we were starting to work on our list over the summer, we did, or was that fall? I'm losing track. Gosh. We were trying to keep the core set in mind also, and to, you know, we keep that as one of the columns, figuring out which other federal programs were recommending the use of some of these measures. So it's not like we were losing sight altogether of the overlap and really actually kind of counting on the core set giving us kind of baseline areas of coverage so that we didn't have to retread some of the same stuff that you all did. But any further discussion about whether we should do a better job of syncing up or specific questions for Karen or discussion on how we get these two sets of measures to work together in the best way? Jenny.
Just to answer the direct question that you asked, Alice, I think that the syncing up is probably valuable because at some point there are more and more projects about the dual, you know, the integrated financing and all in the program. So it seems like that coverage is important. The second question I have is you brought up the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. I know we don't talk about specific diagnoses, but that's an interesting condition to raise because that is such a significant proportion of the population over time that will grow. And I think it gets a proxy measured by function and somewhat some of the conditions. I just wondered if there was any particular work that was being done surrounding that condition. Because I think the Alzheimer's Foundation has noted that by the time we hit 85, about 50% of us will have that condition. So it seems like a major volume driver that we should be looking at.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure about studies, but I mention it because it is one of the biggest cost drivers in our Medicaid fee-for-service population. Tom.
Just while you're thinking things up, we have the all-cause readmission list here, which is the MCQA one, not the CMS one.
Yes, and that's the one that we selected, the MCQA one. And we'll actually be doing future work on it. So as currently specified, if I'm understanding it right, it's only been tested on the Medicare population. So what we will be working on through our work with HRQ is to do feasibility. They'll hopefully be working with MCQA as well to test it on the Medicaid population so that it can be used for our purposes as well. So that's why I talk about it's great to have that extra year because, again, we really had to kind of make sure that we were looking at a nice balance of measures that were ready for prime time, so to speak, but also kind of knowing that there was some work to be done in some of the measurement areas.
Thanks. We also kind of teed up the slide so you could see where some of the common areas are and a couple of the glitchy parts. Laura.
I was just going to say that California has already modified that readmission rate to because it was developed for commercial and Medicare, right. So they already tweaked it a little bit. Take a look at it.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to share it with you.
Right.
If you want. So they've already done that because it just was not meant for the Medicaid population and not made for SNP, for that matter.
Thanks. Cheryl.
I just wanted to highlight on the Alzheimer's area, it's not a quality focus specifically, but we're looking at promising practices for providers. We have a contract who's helping us focus on a couple of areas of promising practices, and we've just really started moving in the identification of them and then pulling out the elements which work well in integrating across Medicare and Medicaid for dual eligibles. And individuals with Alzheimer's is one of the areas that we're looking at focusing on is care provided to individuals and looking at things like unique partnerships or new models of care that are being, you know, are successful in maybe certain areas of the country and we were looking for things that we weren't aware of as well. There were a few models of care we wanted to focus on that we knew were fabulous, but we also wanted to look and see what was out there that maybe we weren't as aware of. So we're looking we have that. It's also looking at individuals with severe mental illness and looking at some things around how to improve home and community-based care connections with managed care and other models. But we just started that. We're very excited about it, but it's in the beginning stages, and you should be hearing more about that soon. So we have that work underway, and it is an area that we want to focus on more in the future. And then also just to highlight, as the technical specifications come out with Karen is lucky enough to just get to work with us as we go through that because we know that there are a lot of issues with states, even aside from what's overlapped with our area of what maybe we would be good to stratify, but just areas of consideration for when you're thinking about duals, what data does the state have for duals, how do you report if you do or don't have the data for certain areas, and we'll be working very closely with Karen and then also working with her going forward on beyond the 26th. So I did want to highlight that. And all of the work here is informing both of those efforts, the technical specs for what exists here, both for when there's overlap in potential stratification and even when there's not because there are issues of reporting as well, and then also for the gaps and additional measures for the future too.
Now, this is I think this is the type of conversation that had we had when we all met to identify the 26 measures had like a few extra days. It had been really great to get to so what, you know, what's not part of the 26 that you would like to be part of the 26, and why didn't we pick those? So, again, that's where we were able to identify large concept, high-level concept areas, but not drill down to, you know, this measure would be perfect if you could do these types of modifications. And certainly the ESPERT measure is a really good example of that because it got to the point where we had to focus on, so let's look at data sources. And ESPERT measure, I think, is medical review as well, and I think that was we knew it wasn't duplicative, but it certainly tried to address the same target population in some instances, but it sometimes came down to if we want to get to a small parsimonious list, what's the easiest way to look at it?
Leonardo.
Yeah, I just have a quick question, which is, like almost all of them, based on my ignorance about how the measurement works at the claims level. I mean, part of the reason we're all interested in the duals, of course, is, you know, it's the sick population. They have a lot of issues. One of the other reasons is that there's this perverse world we live in where people go from having one insurance to having two insurances, and suddenly their lives get worse and more complicated. So what I don't understand is if, let's say, we did a really good job of aligning the adult core measure set with the duals measure set, whether we would be able to run data that, for example, of new duals in the year 2015, how did they do on these measures? How did that group of people do on these measures from 2012 to 2015 as compared to how they did in the year 2015? So we could see, you know, when they became duals, suddenly they started doing much worse on all of these different outcomes, and sort of use the that data to really tell us what the experience of having two insurances that are poorly coordinated might or might, you know, and ideally, with Cheryl's work, you know, we suddenly find out that people are getting much better results by having two. But, you know, I don't understand if that capacity exists, and if that capacity exists, that would make me, you know, make a little more effort to make the two data sets match. And if that capacity doesn't exist, then I'm less interested.
Well, I can make a pitch for why you could be more interested. And I think what you described is the ideal situation. I think that from thinking about how a state reports these measures to CMS, so it's theoretically one state Medicaid program who would pick, you know, these measures to collect it on their Medicaid population overall. So what they send us for the purposes of the initial core set of Medicaid measures is one state aggregated rate. So it wouldn't be able necessarily to get you to the tracking of the dual eligibles across programs and from a fee-for-service to managed care. I think that's what we would want to do. But through the dual demonstration, again, it would be the same state. From a programmatic view, you would want them to only have to program a measure once, but use it for multiple purposes, whether it's a different level for the dual demonstration or to roll it up and send it to CMS for a different purpose. So that's where I think alignment is key, is because it's sometimes the same data people having to program these measures, and it's costly to add one more measure, and it takes time sometimes in the queue, several months, if not a year or so, to add one measure of programming into it. So I think that's where we really want to see how we can align. But I don't know, Cheryl, if you can talk about more the ideal situation where we would be able to track.
I think the view of what we were just talking about, we've been doing a lot of work to get us as close to that as we possibly can. Given that if you look at claims data, I think we could get there in that time frame, and you can look back. But first, you have to link the data sets because they're not linked at all, and you have to link them on a person-specific basis, and you have to link it the same way across states, because you could have someone who's in four different states in 1 year, and you only want to count that as really one person. And then as you link the data sets, you link the claims from Medicare and Medicaid for that person. And then you could potentially, so anything that's claims-based, you could likely get to in a reasonable amount of time. Then you can pull in, can we link that to NGS or OASIS and figure out a way to pull the data for that person from those systems. So I think it depends on if you're looking at purely the way that data is reported for the state voluntary measures. We get the aggregate information, you can look across, and you can make sort of aggregate adjustments. But if you think about these measures, which you can do through claims, and if you can unite the claims data across Medicare and Medicaid, you could do that. It may take us a while to get there, but you could make those, you may be able to get fairly close to being able to see some trends like that, and especially if the data exists some way that we could extract from other systems by linking it to the claim data, because I think to highlight how you can help now for that particular effort, is I'm going to do my plug for the addition to the new flags in the CCW. So it's in your folder, but we are proposing some new flags in the CCW. This is where we've actually already linked some Medicare and Medicaid data at CMS, and the conditions that we're already in the chronic condition warehouse were applied only to Medicare. We have, with my magic pot of money, little tiny bit, are extending those conditions to Medicaid. So you'll be able to look at Medicaid only as well as dual eligibles. And then we have a list of 13 proposed new condition flags that we will be putting in a CCW to apply to both Medicare and Medicaid. It's mostly, the CCW is a research focused, and it's a little bit older. It tends to be about 2 years older because of the verification of the Medicaid data. But that information will be available not only for CMS to do some analysis, but also for researchers and others. So please look at the condition slides. There's more information about each one of these. And we are accepting comments, I believe. Yeah, we're accepting comments for several months. So the extent to which this will allow us to be able to look through across Medicare and Medicaid for both populations and be looking at the right things is extremely helpful. So that was my plug. But, you know, it's hard because of all the data systems and the way things are reported. So if we don't specify ahead of time that we want something stratified by duals, when the state submits it, it will just be an aggregate number, and we don't actually have access to that data necessarily, each individual person's data that's fed into that report, unless it comes through our MCSA system and has been connected in the CCW, and that at this point is claims data.
I was like, oh, sorry. I think Deb had a comment on that same thing first.
This is my personal opinion. Don't anybody take it that I'm commenting for ARC. I'd like to put in a plug for CMS to run those numbers on a national basis so that we have baseline data and trend data. Because given the economic situation and where the states are, it's going to be a long time before the states can actually generate this on the kind of basis we would like in order to push health care. But CMS has the ability to do this across all the states using the data, you know, the IMSIS, which turns into the MAX data, and the denominator file, and the MedPAR file, to at least put out the measures that can be created from the administrative data. And I think it would be extremely helpful to the states and to communities to see, well, look at where my state is on this particular measure. So that's my plug.
So we started doing some of that practice internally. So we've done it, we've run the claims data that Medicaid has available for the children's core set, and we can get close to it, but the reality is it's only fee-for-service. It's not the managed care side of things, so we only get one picture. And if we would do that on the adult side, which we're planning to do as well, more adults are in managed care arrangements, so that would even give us a smaller picture than we have in the kids one. But it's certainly what we're hoping to do in the future because we understand that if there's data that's already coming into us, why would we ask for state to report it to us?
But you could do it for the duals, because most of the encounter data is on the fee-for-service in Medicare. So you could look at some of the measures on a population that we know is very vulnerable and disabled in a uniform way across the states, which we've never been able to do.
And our goal is to provide some of that information. Challenging to bring all of the databases and put all of the pieces together, like New York was talking about. That was for one state. We have all of the states. So we're working on it and just trying to make sure that things like we're all pulling the dual flag from the same place so that it's all consistent. And when you're talking about the myriad data systems that we have at CMS and investigating exactly where that information has come from to make sure that it's consistent and then figuring out the most accurate, it's taking us time because we want to be very thoughtful and make sure that what we put out is consistent for future reports. So we're working on it. We hope to have something out, but the exciting world of systems and data challenges is it's a new one a little bit for me, and It has taken time, but we're hoping to get there and have something to put out, and we're hoping this group will tell us what we should put out there, what's important, how we should look at it, and things like that, especially in what priority, because it takes some time then to get in and go through it. Steve?
Well, just a couple things. I think this is good news and bad news. I think in general, they're complementary steps, at least so far, the Medicaid and our dual eligible set, which is actually nice to see. I think there's more of a disease focus on the Medicaid side in general, but even the depression measure is the exact same one. The second comment, the bad news, I guess, is that it's complementary, and there, you know, the feasibility then becomes a huge issue, I think, for states to measure a lot of the things that we've come up with as a part of our course. The second, as we've had this conversation, I'm wondering, and harkening back, health literacy screening and screening for cognitive impairment did not make our core measures list, and seems like maybe something for modification consideration later today or tomorrow.
All right, Rita, you get the last comment.
Yay. I think, by the way, you did it. I think what you're doing is terrific, you know, and very hard to
boil down and please everybody, and I think you did a terrific job, and we're certainly well pleased with what you did include in behavioral health. My question is really, it's not your problem, it's not Cheryl's problem, it's a general gripe, but when are we going to get encounter data for managed care? I mean, it drives me nuts. They pay on an encounter-based system, and yet we don't get it back. And you know, there's a big encouragement because of integrated care to move to more managed care, but then the data becomes invisible again, the claims data. So it just makes me grind my teeth. So,
what are you doing now, right? You got the answer to the question.
I was there to that.
Starting to be mandatorily reported, and so it'll be available soon. Yeah, just right. It's just hard to see. Yeah. Okay, we are going to move on. Thank you so much, Karen, for spending some time with us today, and especially for being here this morning too. That really helped you. We are going to move to Helen Burston now, who is the Senior Vice President for Performance Measures at NQF. The reason that we asked Helen to be with us today is that we have probably three meetings running, brought up this issue of stratification and how important it is and which measures are appropriate for that and how do you do it. And so, hooray, now we have an expert to help guide that conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure being here. I don't know that I qualify as an expert. This is a pretty tough area. When I was asked to do this, I remember thinking, oh, stratification, okay, so there's some dual, you know, simple way to stratify and understand it, and of course there isn't. So what I'm going to do, actually, if you go to the next slide, is it became clear to me that just talking about, just talking about stratification in and of itself didn't really work for me, and I thought it'd be helpful to take a couple steps back, think about the methodologic issues broadly as they relate to stratification, but also risk adjustment. A lot of the issues that you guys have been bringing up all morning are really kind of front and center. So we've been doing a lot of work in disparities measurement over the last couple of years and thinking about criteria we would use to stratify, indicate which measures should be stratified. So I'm not presenting this as an example of saying pick these measures because they're disparity sensitive, but instead I think the actual criteria might be useful for this group to think through what are those cross-cutting core set of measures, for example, that would work across the fairly heterogeneous population. So I'll give you some of that context. I'll then talk about some of the methodologic approaches to measurement, including stratification, and try not to make your eyes glaze over. And then a little bit about some of the data collection challenges, which have just been elucidated better than I ever could, certainly, knowing that world well. And then potentially just one last thought about, from where I sit, spending, you know, pretty steeped in the measurement side of this house, you know, potential approaches to move forward. So with that, what we've been doing in terms of disparities measurement is trying to think through a strategy of how we could look routinely, as a matter of routine expectation, routinely look at quality measures by race, ethnicity, primary language, and socioeconomic status. Not that the, you know, let's at times pull some measures, let's look for disparities, but how do we make that really part of the fabric of what we do in performance measurement? At the same time, in addition to that strategy, there are a set of standardized, or need to be a set of standardized disparities and cultural competency cross-cutting measures. Issues of access to language services, issues of, you know, potential understanding of information that are needed to monitor equity in healthcare and issues around disparities broadly. And then lastly, we need to make sure we get to the data issues. We need to make sure we've got the data we need to stratify. Do we, in fact, have systems that allow us to find information on race, ethnicity, language, et cetera, to be able to stratify? So to me, those three approaches, and you'll see on my last slide, really ring true for me for the duals. I think there is a set of them that work well, of measures that work really well on each of those three strategies. So just briefly, this is just an example from the National Healthcare Disparities Report this past year, just the way they've been able to, for example, show all the measures in the National Healthcare Quality Report stratified, and here they list ethnicities and race, ethnicity, and income, and at least being able to look at, for example, the distribution of the core measures for which selected populations are better, same, or worse quality of care. I was at ARC with Deb many years ago and led the first National Healthcare Disparities Report, and this was intentional. The idea of picking the same measures that we used for quality but stratifying was really the strategy we thought of to start with. And these are just a couple of example, very clear examples of where the NHCR provides clear comparison to reference group differences in some especially important areas. So just to give you an example of what you could do if you, in fact, had stratification capacity. So let me tell you a little bit about the way the Disparities Committee has been thinking about these disparity-sensitive criteria. We had an initial set that's now been updated, and our committee is actually meeting later this week to go through the initial exercise of looking at the first, I think, 150 measures or so that we've gone through this exercise on. But essentially, and I think these are directly relevant if you take out disparities and think about duals in some instances here, what's the prevalence of a given condition as to whether or not it potentially would be something you'd want to stratify or include on a core set? Is there a known quality gap? That's the issue that came up this morning. You know, for example, Steve was saying, you know, is there any evidence that comfortable dying is worse if you're a dual than a non-dual patient as one consideration? And then what's the impact? How much does that condition, cross-cutting topic, whatever the case may be, ultimately affect that community? Again, I think something you guys have been raising all morning in terms of impact on the dual community. The second tier is an interesting one that we've added with the help of a very elegant submission paper done by Joe Betancourt and Joel Weissman at Mass General, helping us think through what is that next set of criteria. And much of this, again, I think you were talking about this morning as well. You know, when is there care with a high degree of discretion on the part of the clinician? When are there communication-sensitive services particularly important here when we're talking about issues of language and culture? And the last one I thought was especially important consideration for the duals, which is there a set of measures that are especially dependent on the social determinants of health as something for us to be thinking about? Issues around behavioral aspects of care, self-management, adherence, et cetera, that I thought might just be food for thought as well for this group. And so that then leads you to then think about if you are going to stratify or case or adjust or whatever the case may be, there's a series of sort of methodologic approaches that you would need to think through. And I'll just walk through each of these very quickly. So, for example, reference points. The key thing here would be what's the choice of the reference group that you would actually want to look at? So if you're really wanting to compare the duals against, is it against other patients with Medicaid? Is it against other patients with the broader population? And typically that's the group you would consider the historically advantaged population. Missing out all the folks in the commercial plans obviously is a pretty big gap when you start thinking about the comparisons here. And just one simple slide, just again, depending on how you look at your reference population and looking at it over time, you would differentially view some of these changes and disparities over time, depending on the time and the reference group. So just something important to keep in mind. And again, this slide is very simple. It's black-white. If we actually wanted to look truly at the issues of disparity and started to bring in race, ethnicity, language, SES, it starts to look like the complex map we've been talking about, no pun intended, for all the different subpopulations and the duals as well. It would not be a simple map, for example, if you looked at the readmission rate of those dual-eligible versus others. There are so many. You would really want to dive deep and see whether, in fact, it's the complex medical issues, whether, in fact, it's those in nursing homes, whether it's the ones with serious mental illness or behavioral health issues. The second issue is obviously you're going to want to also consider the absolute versus the relative disparities or the relative differences in the case of the duals. Can you look at those differences potentially? And you actually may have very different conclusions as to whether or not the gaps are closing or whether the comparisons are especially important, and that's another one to consider. Paired versus summary statistics is another one for your consideration. If there's lots of multiple groups, this gets very, very complex, and the reports tend to be not very user-friendly. It's very hard to look at 6 reference groups against 5 reference groups, and very, very difficult. The problem is we also don't want to blend all those together and lose some of that detail that's really useful for improvement. So if you know, for example, of the duals, the readmission rate is really driven by those, I'll just make it up, I don't know this for a fact, but if it's really driven by those with the complex medical needs who are probably nursing home eligible but still living in the community, that gives you a very different sense of what the results would be rather than just saying the rate of readmissions is higher for duals. You would also want to think about, you know, those summary statistics, of course, not only can obscure the differences of the subpopulations, but are also important in terms of looking at issues of directionality. If some go like this and some go like this, at the end they could look like they're the same and you'd miss that rich detail if you actually had the subpopulation to consider. Interaction effects is going to be an issue, of course, depending on how these populations come together. I won't say more about that. That gets pretty pointy-headed. Sample size considerations are going to be really important as well, and this already came up this morning. The smaller the numbers for some of these subpopulations, the harder it's going to be to find data and information to show that those differences you're seeing are true versus chance. And there are lots of options to consider there. Are they summary statistics? Are they composites? The issue raised this morning. And yes, we also agree almost everything should be composited, by the way. So we're with you on that. But you also have the option of potentially combining data over multiple years to get it enough of a sample size to be able to look over time. And probably the biggest issue that always comes up is this issue of risk adjustment versus stratification. At least our current policy, which I don't think is going to change, although it comes up constantly, is that NQF currently does not recommend that risk models include factors that would otherwise demonstrate disparities. So, for example, we don't recommend that measure developers include race or ethnicity as part of risk models because it then obscures differences for us to look at the post-hoc analyses to compare by those populations. This is a big issue, and for those of you who have been following our recent project on all-cause readmission, it has been a very, very contentious point of discussion, particularly about the SES of the patient population, and especially the issues you guys talked about this morning about the community capacity to provide the ongoing care beyond the hospitalization. So sometimes there's been a distinction of is it the provider-based issue, or is it really the community's capacity to help with that? So certainly, as we've been thinking about it, you know, both case mix adjustment and stratification are both potential ways to avoid really what's unintended consequences. We don't want to penalize providers who are perhaps taking care of the sickest patients, the point you raised earlier, Rita, about not wanting people to avoid the patients for whom the delta would be worse, for example. But at the same time, we don't want to obscure those differences either. Interestingly, the committee ultimately recommended that the all-cause readmission measure not include race, ethnicity, or SES, but that there be a recommendation that like hospitals be compared to like hospitals in terms of the post-hoc presentation and of the results. Just, again, it's sort of a step in that direction. And stratification should be performed when there's sufficient data to do so or data to allow you to even see it because it does allow you to get at that. And I was actually struck when you guys were talking about the core Medicaid set. In fact, if you look at the way even the ARC-SNAC had done it, the subcommittee, was they specifically went through the exercise of looking first at adults, those who had complex medical needs, maternal reproductive health. So, again, there was this sense from that core set as well that there were those subgroups and consider which measures work for those groups as well. And then, again, risk adjustment, at least from where we sit, has largely been for these kinds of issues relegated to where we think it's highly dependent on community factors that go beyond the provider's control, some of the issues you were raising earlier as well, Adam, which would be very broader and I think somewhat different for the duals, but an interesting discussion I think for you to have. So as I was reading to kind of feel like I was educated in this population, though I've taken care of many duals, I don't, certainly not an expert in the dual population, you know, there is such a mix of this population, the seniors and non-elderly people with disabilities, they are generally poorer, worse health status. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Use more health services, disproportionate share of Medicare spending, and a major driver for higher spending. And I found this recent CMS policy brief that was really excellent, looking at the much higher rate of avoidable hospitalizations, which I didn't see on the core list, as an interesting concept to consider. So as I thought about what the approaches might be, I then pulled directly out of your very nicely done report and the MedPAC report, that again, it's this issue of the distinct groups with widely different care needs that keeps driving me in sort of finding this issue of stratification very fuzzy in some ways. And then you did a great job, I thought, in the report of listing out all these potential risk factors, and it was nice to see that some of those will, in fact, come onto this chronic conditions warehouse to allow you to capture some of these. But again, if you look at this whole list of condition of risk factors, it certainly would be a challenge for stratification. Some of these could be elements of a risk model, but many of these would be very difficult to get, particularly as we were talking earlier, Ron was talking about administrative data, for example, very difficult to certainly get at issues of cognitive impairment or what's frailty, for example. Probably difficult to assess depending on the data source. So certainly you also indicated in your report there's lots of barrier stratification. It's not clear what those strata are, but I think it would be a really useful exercise for this group to actually weigh in here because I think we'd learn a lot. The strata would very much differ depending on the measures, for example. If it's mental health, substance abuse, behavioral health measures, the strata would probably be slightly different than if you were looking at the complex care of the chronically elderly. Probably issues with insufficient numbers, as you pointed out, and the linkages we just heard about are still becoming quite complex to identify those key risk factors that at least you laid out in your report. So finally, just leaving you with this, I think there are three potential measurement approaches for this population, and you've talked about much of this today. I do think stratification is still pretty limited by the heterogeneity of the population, unless you try to really upfront decide what those strata are and think about how you might move forward. You'd actually need some information to think about what those distinct cohorts are so that you would be able to stratify. And then to me, it still seems like there is also the opportunity to also look towards some of the measure sets that we either have or are developing for some of those clear cohorts. So, you know, there may be measures most suitable for the quality issues of those different cohorts. Behavioral health, for example, nursing homes, home health, so measures that could be applicable depending on where the patient is in their episode, in their journey, that may be very applicable, but perhaps not applicable to the whole set of duals. And then finally, I think there is still a need to think about what are those cross-cutting measures, knowing their worst health status, worst outcomes, et cetera, that cut across all of those cohorts that would still be especially useful to have a sort of almost prime core or the prioritized core of ones that really work well across all populations in addition to the measure sets for the cohort and when you can, the stratification across the strata. My father, before he passed away, found this quote from me that I adore and I think it's directly relevant to this as well. Not everything that counts can be counted and not everything that can be counted counts. Turns out it was Albert Einstein, a very brilliant man, but you can't improve what you don't measure. So with that, more food for thought than anything else. I'm happy to kind of go through just a bit of a measurement geek exercise if that's useful. That's all. Thanks.
Thanks. We're going to take a couple specific clarifying questions for Helen at this point and then have a broader conversation after Tom's presentation. So any clarification needed at this point? Rhonda?
I've kind of lost track. How close are we to some standardization in the definition of race, ethnicity, and other disparities?
Fairly far along, I would argue. I think the feds have really helped here. The standards are available. They've now been built into meaningful use. So I think the standards are there, Rhonda. I think the biggest challenge is they're not being collected. So I think we've got standards and no data. Sometimes we have data and no standards. I think this is, eventually I think we'll get to both.
Adam?
Just to take this further upstream than even where you began, the reasons why we're even thinking about stratification for risk adjustment, because I've heard, you know, a few different things in the different conversations we've had. You know, one is to protect providers against adverse selection so that when you measure them, they don't appear to be performing poorly merely because they're taking care of a more difficult population. So that's one thing we've talked about. We've talked about being able to see if our vulnerable dually eligible populations are treated differently in the healthcare system compared to other populations. Mm-hmm. And I guess then the third thing is that among the dually eligibles, we have very different populations, and should we, you know, group them? So we're talking about different purposes of this exercise, right?
Absolutely. And I would actually add a fourth, which is that assuming you know which populations they are, you would also want to be able to target which of those subpopulations are at greatest risk for quality improvement, since that's really our end game. So if you actually had the data on the subpopulations and you could stratify, for example, you would know if I'm just making this up. Let's just say that the folks with serious mental illness are the ones who are driving your admission rate or driving your preventable hospitalization rate, and that offers a very different improvement strategy for a state or a plan than I think just saying it's the duals. Does that make sense?
Good. And would you include stratification by, quote, dual status as stratification? I mean, it's one thing that we've talked about in terms of because of the small numbers for the population.
It's a really interesting question. I'd be curious to hear from, you know, Cheryl and the CMS folks. I mean, I think there's some benefit there in terms of, you know, that CMS policy brief I read last week showing that there's a higher preventable admission rate. It's helpful, but to me it's almost more like hypothesis generating rather than hypothesis proving. It's great information that helps you think through what your strategies are, but without more information to take the deeper dive, I'm not sure how it helps too much without being able to get into the substrata, really, or those cohorts. But I'd love to hear this group's impact. I mean, you're certainly closer to this than I am.
I think we'll have Tom talk next about the usefulness of stratifying.
Thank you very much. At some of these other meetings, we've had the opportunity to talk in terms of being able to have some data, Rita. And I've got, 10 minutes? Last week at the NQF Health Plan Council, I asked Helen to speak, and I commented that she was able to get through in a short time what it would have taken me an hour, but I'm just a simple country doctor from Kentucky, and so she's from a little further north.
Way
so for that reason, I talked to Brad St. Martin, who is really going to give the presentation. Brad, we were fortunate enough to get from Yale's School of Public Health and Epidemiology. He's done a lot of studies in South America, and so that made him perfect for looking at Humana's experience with dual eligible. So, Brad, you can speak a little faster than me.
Thank you very much. Well, now that Helen has pointed out all the limitations to my study, I hope that it will still be of some help.
That's intentional, because we did not want to go too deep a dive, but we got capacity.
Yeah, so what I hope to do is I've been on some of the previous calls, so I'm hoping to answer some questions, and maybe it will help you formulate some more questions for finalizing this MAP dual eligible measurements. What I did is I was comparing the Humana Medicare population to the Humana dual-eligible population. And there were three major objectives that I had in trying to compare these, is to assess the distribution of the costs across Humana's total Medicare population, which is about 1.8 million, compared to the Humana's dual-eligible population of 202,000. Compare the distribution of the members' conditions between the two populations by hierarchical condition categories, HCCs, which are used by CMS, as well as compare the populations by HEDIS denominator and numerator compliance statuses for a few different HEDIS categories that we spoke with Sarah about. So first, looking at the Humana total Medicare population, the distribution of costs, I apologize if you can't really see some of that. Okay. Oh, okay. But what we're looking for here in this distribution is the 80-20 rule. So the top 20% of the members are accounting for 80% of the cost. And what we found here with the total Medicare population is that that top 20% accounts for roughly 73% of the total cost. So the next question would be, where do the duals fall within this breakdown of the total Medicare population? And what I found was that the top 20% of the total Medicare population includes 30% of the total dual population. Also, if you go a little bit further out, 50% of the total Medicare population includes 60% of the dual population. So it's slightly skewed to the higher, but it's not 75 or 80% that fall in that top 20%. The next thing that I found that was very interesting, but not really unexpected, is that the highest cost members, the majority of their spend is within the inpatient, and as you go down the line to the members who are spending less as a percentage of the total cost, the majority of their spend moves to physician as the inpatient goes from 64 to 0 and physician from 18 to 67. That's, I think, really interesting as you compare that to the dual eligible population. So next, I'm just looking at the Humana's dual eligible population. And the first thing that we were looking at is to determine whether we were still seeing that 80-20 relationship, or is it more evenly distributed? And what we found is that the top 20% of the dual eligible members account for 69% of the total cost, so a little bit less than the total Medicare population, but it's still about the 20-70, I guess. The next thing that was interesting is looking at the inpatient and the physician costs and the distribution there. The dual eligible population accounts for a higher percentage of the total costs coming from inpatient across all members compared to the total Medicare population. And the physician costs across all of the breakdowns account for a smaller percentage of the total costs. So that would make it seem like individuals within this dual eligible population are overutilizing the inpatient and underutilizing physician services. The next thing that I looked at is comparing disease prevalence using the HCCs. And I found a paper, because there's quite a few HCCs, so I found a paper by the CMS Office of Research that kind of groups some of the HCCs into these nine condition categories, cancer, diabetes, CHF, CAD, and you can see the rest. So first I wanted to analyze the Medicare versus the dual population just for, I guess, relative prevalence, and found that the dual eligibles have significantly higher rates of all conditions except for cancer and heart arrhythmia compared to the Medicare-only population. As you can see, diabetes as well as COPD, there's 8% increases compared to the Medicare-only population. I also took those nine conditions and spread them out to determine the number of comorbid conditions that these members had. And as you can see over on the right, that dual eligibles, when comparing their mean, had significantly higher number of comorbid conditions with a mean of 1.58 compared to the Medicare only, which had a mean of 1.24. Both of the medians were centered around one comorbid condition. But I thought that was interesting. And clearly, that number of comorbid conditions is tapered off to the right and skewed to the right. So the next thing wanted to look at is just a few different HEDIS measures. That's comprehensive diabetes care measures, antidepressant medication management, and one that we were talking about earlier, which is the follow-up after hospitalization of mental illness. So the first thing that I noticed is the percentage of the total population that ended up in the denominator for these for the dual eligible population is higher in all three of these measures. This is not unexpected, as we see higher prevalence of these conditions in the dual eligible population. But it was a little surprising to me because when I looked at continuous enrollment for the two populations, the Medicare only population, they were continuously enrolled throughout the year, 82%, whereas it was around 50% for the dual eligible population. So I was worried that a large percentage of the members wouldn't make the denominator status. However, they still were ended up in the denominator a greater percentage of the time than the Medicare only. I also noticed that for the most part, the process measures showed lower compliance overall. If you look at the antidepressant Medicare management, the follow-up after hospitalization after 7 and 30 days, those are all worse, as well as the whether or not they received an LDL test or an HbA1c test. The only process measure that they produced better was the nephropathy test compliance. However, as you can see, for the LDL control, which is less than 100, and the HbA1c percentage poor, they actually were better than the Medicare-only population in those. So I thought that was quite interesting as well as within those outcome measures. And so overall, the insights and conclusions that I brought from this are that lower utilization of physician services may be leading to higher costs due to inpatient visits and decreased follow-up of mental conditions in Medicare management for this dual eligible population. The dual eligible members do have been shown to have a significantly higher number of comorbid conditions compared to the Medicare only population. And the dual eligible population, as I just stated, had a larger percentage of their total population in the HEDIS denominator compared to the Medicare only population. So I hope I did good thing quick there.
You know what? I think it's important to note that this is a managed care plan. It's a Medicare Advantage plan. So being able to say that this set of characteristics is something that could be applied universally is something that we're not able to say. So there may be some differences right in there, but at least I think this gives some credence to the view that we're not dealing with the dual eligibles, at least within Humana, as being a uniformly sick group. They are somewhat sicker than our Medicare Advantage members, but there's a lot of people who are relatively healthy among this group.
Helen, do you have any thoughts about using this kind of analysis?
It's incredibly interesting. You should write it up for Academy Health, having just spent the weekend reviewing 130 abstracts on quality and value. It's great stuff. I think it's a great starting point. You know, I think it's a really interesting thing to kind of scratch your head and say, well, are some of these outcome measures, are some of these control measures doing better because they're seen more often, which there's some very good data to suggest that's the case. Are there some of these other, it's some of the things you kind of want to study more, but it does sort of give you the sense that it's great stuff to start the conversation, but it really doesn't end it as you go down. Tom. Yeah.
And Brad did this in 10 days.
Okay, Rita, go ahead.
Yeah, this is great data, and you did a very nice job also with your pyramids, really portraying the data in a way that's easily understandable, and that is not easy to do, you know. So it's very nicely
put out there, and it's fascinating. I love data. It always brings up more questions than it answers, but, you know, I love it anyway. I have one question, one thought about the inpatient, the much higher inpatient rate. Did you look at all on how many compared the Medicare-only as versus the dual, on how, the percent that came through the emergency department as versus elective admissions?
I did not look at that.
It just might be interesting.
We're getting down the list of the next steps.
Here's a suggestion. Because I just think that some of the duals, one reason they're using it more often is they're more in crisis around something. They had a fall or they, you know, got severely depressed and couldn't get out of bed. And, you know, there's precipitating factors more often with the duals, then I think you'll see, and one measure of that is whether they came to your emergency department or not. So, just a thought.
I do think that's interesting. And another thing that I kind of was wondering is, because the duals pyramid is a slight upward shift compared to the total Medicare population, we are seeing that decrease in the inpatient and the increase in the physician services. And I'm wondering if that shift is it like the chicken or the egg? Is that causing the higher inpatient, or is the higher inpatient causing that higher increase in cost?
Yeah, my gut is the inpatient costs are so much higher that they're pushing around the proportion more so than the lower cost outpatient. But, you know, that's just my guess.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks. Two questions. One, in your 9 diagnoses, I saw you didn't have any mental health conditions or substance abuse conditions. And did you guys, you know, where those might fall out if you'd put, you know, a psychiatric diagnosis in there?
I did look further at a few of the psychiatric HCCs just in general. From the CMS Office of Research, didn't actually have a group of that, but I knew that you guys were interested in that as well. And I did see significant increases in all of, there was, I looked at 3 or 4 different psychiatric measures. But I just didn't have time and was also keeping it. I haven't carved them up. Yeah, sorry.
One of the biggest issues in our current resource use project is interesting how many of the measures, in fact, carve out mental health, behavioral health, or pharmacy costs. And so you're looking at sometimes a very skewed set of data. So, in fact, mental health could be quite high if they're in. Oh, great. Okay, great.
One other question was, I would agree, coming to, as an ER physician, I mean, I see these people all the time, and usually they don't just come by, you know, come through the emergency room, but they come by 911 through the emergency room. So really, these are people who don't have cars, and so because of this crisis, that they're accessing disproportionately through use of a community's resources of police, fire, and ambulance in this entire thing, which tends to drag and be an unaccounted cost. The other thing I'm sort of interested in is I really love super users. They're just my heroes. And to me, the 1% that can generate the 13%, have you had a chance to kind of look under the hood and see what part of the engine might be broken there most frequently?
I haven't had a chance to look at that. I mean, this was just, I had a little bit over a week to
get I understand. But I think that to me, that's really, I mean, if you're really, obviously, if you're going to get the most bang for your buck, if you can go for that superpopulation, identify it, and if we could, I mean, I'd rather stratify that way almost than any other stratification method these days. If you really want to try to get value and you can go for the most broken things in the system first, I think that that's another useful way to kind of look at what should be fixed quickest if there are quick fixes, because literally 1% of people is 1% of a million. That's what, 10,000? Did I do the numbers? I'm not sure, but I mean, that's a lot of people, but that's nothing compared to the spread of trying to put it across this entire population. And what is it uniquely about those people, I think, would be a really interesting exercise.
And in our operational piece, that's where exactly case management fits in. Stuff is the top 5% of individuals, and they all have unique stories, which is why you do case management.
Yeah, that's what we're actually in our innovation project in San Diego. We're looking at 1,000 people, half of whom have this kind of insurance, who've used the ambulance at least 3 times in 6 months, and you can actually get that kind of information from ambulance systems, which tends to be a discussion point that we haven't ever, we repeatedly don't talk about the fact that public information systems should include ambulance data because it's really part of the health system.
Adam?
I would just urge caution in your first conclusion there, because you're comparing percentages. You also have to look at absolute numbers and per member per month or per member per year costs. So, for example, you know, in that top tier, the absolute number may for physician visits and outpatient care may actually be the same.
I am looking at these are all in per member per month costs.
So, but your conclusion was that there's less percentage-wise, there's less care going to the outpatient for the duals, and that may be accounting for a higher inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
It's a higher inpatient percentage, but I don't know if it's a higher the outpatient cost in absolute terms may not be less.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick clarifying question. Are these mostly special needs plan enrollees, institutionalized, non-institutionalized?
Non-institutionalized,
I
think
I was still talking. Yeah. You might add to your list.
Okay.
You might add to your list links of the stay. I suspect that there's probably length of stay differences across the two populations. And ARC recently put out a stat brief on expenditures, concentration of expenditures looking at the U.S. population. And so you might want to take a look at that as like a benchmark in terms of, you know, not just focusing on Medicare, but this would be everybody.
Samantha, I just want to also remind folks that this is your last opportunity to kind of touch on Helen's initial presentation about the purposes of stratification and what we should be recommending in the final report around stratification of measures for dual. So questions that are pertinent to that area too, this would be the time to bring them up.
Yeah. This would be probably more of a comment since there's so much controversy still surrounding the whole risk adjusting versus vis-a-vis stratification. Just that I guess each of our reports have some couple of paragraphs to explain, you know, the decision to think of it comparing like to like, it, just so that it comes up, because I think it becomes an automatic quick question that people would just... It's almost an FAQ type of thing to really tee up.
I guess, you know, one thing maybe, Laura, you could comment on this too. One of the things that we keep, you know, it's brought up several times in the conversations with states that because of these, you know, the star ratings and SNP plans being applied kind of across the board without respect to what proportion of Medicare enrollees are duals, and that health plans are worried that the star ratings will treat them unfairly because of the differences in the population. And you look at Humana's numbers, they don't look that dramatic. Like it would throw you into a completely different star category, although I know sometimes the differences in the star ratings can be just a percent or two, but... Any comment on that?
Well, our population right now is very small. It's only 2,400. That probably will increase over the next year if we get the dual pilot in California because they're looking at that. So I think the numbers have a lot to do with it, too, because of the small denominators that we have right now. I think some of it was also the self-reported data. I think we talked about that when you have self-reported data, you have people with cognitive disorders trying to remember about their visit to the doctor when they can't remember anything that they had for breakfast that day. I mean, the you know, and that really getting eliminating those from the denominator, excluding those denominators was one of the concerns that we had. I think we actually need to see, now that I get the floor, a special SNP cap survey. I think the one for Medicaid isn't quite right, and I don't think the one for Medicare is quite right. I think there actually needs to be a special SNP survey that really looks at the literacy of this population. And my other comment or question about, we look at disparities in great detail with our Medicaid population. We look at it by SPD versus non-SPDs or ABDs. We look at gender. We look at ethnicity and language. And we can break all of our HEDIS data down by that. It's a truly, really interesting. We look at statistical significance, which I guess you did as well. So we can look at that. We don't get that kind of information on Medicare. We only, it's not reported like that. Medicaid, we get all that data on. And Medicare, I guess it's optional that they report it, because I only have like maybe 70% of that in my, because we tried to look at that as well. So, you know, I also have to look at the languages. And then the other unique feature, which I don't know you have, I think we have, and that's homelessness with this population, which is why they show up in the emergency room and they get picked up on by ambulances or down on Skid Row or wherever they are. I'm always amazed at the homelessness of the population. Maybe that's just unique to LA, but that also impacts your inpatient and ER rates as well. So there's a,
it's housing prices.
I carpool with my HUD. I know there's stuff out there, but they obviously, you know, have some problems with that. So I think that makes your access more difficult and they are more challenging.
Thanks. Cheryl?
I just wanted to highlight a couple things. One, I think just going back to the statutory creation of our office, and one of the statutory charges is that we improve quality for dual eligibles. So that in and of itself is one reason to stratify specifically for duals, because we have to be able to show that we are actually moving towards improvement of quality for duals. Even if we don't take that group and compare it to another group, we need to be able to look at duals and indicate improvement in quality for those individuals. And then I think it's important to also think about, we're at the beginning of the discussion. We all wish the discussion were much further along than it actually is, but we need to be able to look at the dual eligibles, I think, as a group and look at the measures that are appropriate for them as a group. But that doesn't mean we stop. It just means that's where we continue with more questions, because there are always more questions and subpopulations and which subpopulations. So I think that's important, that not to minimize the importance of that first step or wherever that is in the continuum, but it is in the beginning of the discussion, and it's setting the right questions now to make sure that as we go forward, we're measuring the right things. And I just wanted to pull back and let us think about that as well.
Thanks. Jim?
I would just echo that, too. I happen to also be president of the Heart Association in San Diego for about the last 10 years. And AHA takes very different perspectives on addressing chronic cardiovascular disease depending on the race of the community. There are wonderful strategies specifically for African-American populations, Hispanic populations, completely different approaches to getting, in other words, community matters and location matters, and I think these things matter too. So I think somehow we have to have that information to tailor the strategy to be most successful.
Do you have another comment, Laura?
I concur. I think just just looking at the stratification and the disparities, that's just the beginning of it. Then you got to start digging in and looking at your barriers. And we've done that with breast cancer screening, for example, in African Americans. So now we can look at what geographical areas is it, you know, and then we can get into that too and actually target our interventions to that population. And we've made some headway that way, but you've got to drill down even further beneath the surface to do that.
Samantha.
Thanks. I'm not exactly sure where this comment fits in, but I was struck by your findings from the health plan's data that looked at accessing physician services versus using inpatient services. And I think we all kind of wonder, are you accessing what's the most appropriate setting, or are you accessing what you can get to? And so I don't know the dynamics of your health plan, but was there any thought in kind of looking at urban or rural differences in the use of your care setting?
No, I wasn't able to look at that, but there's definitely issues with that, as well as different types of maybe Medicare Advantage programs, whether it's an HMO or a PPO, and different cost structures built around that, to whether or not they'll have incentives or disincentives to go to a physician services or inpatient care. But those are definitely issues that are important to this as well.
Just to that particular point, and I mean, this is a reality, is that the incentives that we're allowed to use in for a Medicare member are very minimal compared to what we can do with our commercial membership. And so it's trying to get to Maslow's hierarchy of need and being able to get to the services that people appreciate, need, and want.
Thank you for bringing that data to us and doing the work in such a short period of time. And thank you, Helen, for your presentation. Yeah. So we're going to go ahead and take a break now. Sarah, go ahead.
Before we break, we just wanted to offer a brief opportunity for public comment, since there's been two sessions since we last did that. So if there's anyone in the room who'd like to come up to a microphone, or Nicole, if there's anyone on the phone.
Over the phone again, that's star one.
Sounds, Nicole, like you have no one. There's no one in the room, so we'll go to a break. Thank you.
Alrighty, we don't want to keep you here through your dinner hour, since we have no food coming for dinner. And then your attention will really start flagging. So you might have thought that we were all caught up on our agenda, but you perhaps forgot that we skipped over a couple little slides in order to get back on task. Sorry. So we will, after Anita's presentation, we're going to loop back around to a couple of those topics about unintended consequences and gaps. And we're going to give you a little bit of homework so we don't have to take as much time as we originally had planned on the agenda, but just so you know, we might run a little bit late and not be able to adjourn on the dot at 4 o'clock. So, and Anita.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to be here. Actually, I would really like a one-week retreat with all of you together. This has been incredible. I mean, I've just really enjoyed this morning, and you've given me a lot of food for thought. And these are issues that I've been thinking about for a long time. Granted, it's been one component of this, the long-term services and supports piece, which, if you look under the hood, that's probably the most complex service-intensive group that we have. And I'm afraid that I'm here to talk more about gaps than what we have going on, because we're grossly in need of national, well-tested, endorsed measures. I've grown up in this system, and I can tell you that people that do research in long-term services and supports, as a rule, really don't even understand what endorsement is. I mean, because we've been looking for so long at state-specific or population-specific measures that we really we're lacking in well-tested, standardized measures. Another complication is that everything that really emanates from that field is very individually centered. It's individual centric, because there's been a 30-year history of doing person-centered care. There's been a 30-year history of doing quality of life measures as a result of the forced deinstitutionalization that happened some 30, 40 years ago. So that's really, they're the two pieces that the system really has as its foundation. And so, as I said, it's very population specific and quality of life specific in terms of measures. I'm going to really have more of a conversation with you because I would like to learn more about where you're going, because I think the outcome of what you produce is going to be the most valuable for what we need. If you can think of CMS and where we're all coming from, we have this dysfunctional system that's separated by financing structures. Many people have mentioned that today. And what that does is actually preclude us from really knowing holistically what's happening with any one person. We have very little individual level data, so it's hard to understand some of these very complex situations, social situations. This morning I was on my way here on the train, and my husband's in the hospital right now with hospital readmission. Typical situation, probably could have been avoided. And I started thinking about what it would have been like if he was dually eligible. You know, would he have been able to have access to a specialized surgeon because he has type 1 diabetes? He has several chronic conditions. Would he have been able to get to his doctor appointment, which is an hour away? He got a second opinion from somebody who was very specialized. He's in a hospital that's an hour away. Could he have gotten transportation there? What if he was in a wheelchair? Would he have been able to access his doctor appointment? Would he have been able to get up on the doctor's table? Or if he was deaf, would there be somebody there to speak to him? These are all the situations that really impact access with this population. And I don't believe that we've even started to peel that onion yet. It's a very complex situation. And as we look at measures, I think the challenge for us is really to look at how we can begin to get at some of those social issues, because they're the issues that really impact the kinds of services that people are getting. I want to say a little bit about person-centered care, because I think it's very important here. One of the things, I talked to some folks at the Office on Disabilities before I came here, and they were very committed to making sure that I understood person-centered concepts and in long-term services and supports, that everything starts at the individual and goes from there. Now, we're really, in the kind of discussion we've had today, we're starting here and going down to the individual. In much of what's been tested within the disabilities community, it starts here and generalizes, much like the stratification that you've been talking about. And so the other thing is that to standardize a person-centered plan is very difficult. If you look at an individual who has extremely complex needs, they're going to go to the table, they're going to have unique needs, they're going to have unique support systems, they're going to have unique combination of chronic and disabling conditions, all of which require a composite of a lot of different kinds of interventions. So if we can find a way to really start at that individual level with social issues and then begin to go outward from there, I think we can begin maybe to have a better idea of what we need to measure. But as I said, I think this group, more than any, you're really able to take a look beyond where we are in our little silos to what happens at the individual level and all of the things that impact the kind of care a person gets. So, I have control of this. Okay. As I mentioned last time I was here, that our long-term services and support system is primarily through Medicaid. 45% of the home and community-based service system is the long-term care system in Medicaid. So it's not a small percentage. It has grown tremendously in the last 20 years. The other 55% is institutions. The system has been very state-centric, and I think it's we have very little standardization. Deb Potter has done some incredible work in, along with Sarah Galantowicz, in looking at administrative data and trying to get to the bottom of some of the information we can get through claims. I think that needs to be advanced, and I'm hoping that it will be over time so that we can really get the rest of the information we need. We're in the process right now of testing CAPS for home and community-based services and also taking a look at the CARE tool to see to what extent it can be used as a functional assessment for folks who have long-term services and support needs. The other thing that we're going to do as part of that demonstration is take a look at health information technology, because I'm sure you're familiar with the whole meaningful use concept and the incentives that are there for providers. Interestingly enough, long-term services and supports was left totally out of that mix. And so when we take a look at how we can build that into this very decentralized, very complex system, it poses a lot of challenges. I mean, you're looking at paraprofessional staff. You're looking at people who are service providers that might be your neighbor, to group home staff, to staff that are in an assisted living facility. So the complexity is just tremendous. But what we're hoping to do is use personal health records and begin to find out whether we can develop a standard for e-long-term services and supports record and test that out. So that will be coming out soon. I can't say a whole lot more about it, but we're very excited that we're going to have some kind of standardized national things coming out of that demonstration. Those are three environmental scans that were done, and there's, of course, the Deficit Reduction Act work that Deb did on claims data. There's the AARP recently released indicators, and then the National Balancing Indicators. Two out of three of those are system and, you know, they're not individual level measures. And I think that begins to raise some issues because we really don't understand what it is about home and community-based services specifically or at a granular level that really has an impact on people's lives, because the way home and community-based services have been structured, every state defines them differently. You know, there's no one personal care definition. There's no one assisted living definition. So it becomes really hard to know what intervention is impacting what outcome. So as I said, we're really faced more with gaps than we are with answers. But as we start to look at some domains that rise to the top, a lot of these really do relate to quality of life domains. And I took a look at all of those that are here and came up with probably about four that really rise to the top. One is control or person-centeredness. You know, that's in the National Quality Strategy, critically important. I would venture to say that it's probably got a different definition in the disability community than it has in the primary healthcare community. It really has sort of come from the disabilities rights movement. But I also think that the whole notion of autonomy and looking at physicians losing some of their hegemony in that system is really taking hold, and I think it represents a real change in our healthcare system. And then the second piece would be access, all kinds of access, not just access to healthcare, but transportation, ADA issues, language, everything comes into play there. Care coordination. I think thinking about care coordination a little differently may not, and I don't know, this is something that is going to have to be tested out, but I don't think we necessarily need to think of it in terms of a person providing coordination. I think as we begin to look at health information technology, we're looking at other tools that are going to enable a better mix and a better integration of information. And finally, community. Community has a whole different element to everything that we're talking about. It's a very decentralized environment. It's not a hospital. It's not an institution. So just some last comments. Probably about 20-some years ago, I read an article by some futurists that were, they did an analysis across many different schools of information, you know, math, physics, biology, and they studied trends that they thought would happen at the turn of the century. And one of the things they said is that they predicted that in the future there would be a lot of decentralization, much more complexity, and much more focused on much more focused on individuals. And I think we're living that right now. I mean, I really think that what we're seeing in the healthcare system is no less than a paradigm change. And it's a matter of keeping up, because I think the things that we're looking at right now are even becoming outdated. 2014 is going to happen. States are coming in with changing their service delivery systems. You know, I can see a time when fee-for-service is slowly going to disappear. There's 1115s where states are beginning to coordinate across all their service delivery systems. And that whole notion of shared accountability poses a real dilemma, I think, to providers and to all of us, because what does it mean to have shared accountability for people who have very complex needs? What happens when they don't have caregivers? How do we assure their health? And how do we refocus on a person-centric system? What kind of measures do we have at that level? And then what kind of tools do we need in order to realize that, besides health information technology? So anyway, that's what little bit I can add to this discussion, and I would really be interested in hearing your thoughts.
So in terms of where you're at now in the planning for the specific caps and other family of measures, could you give us a glimmer of when on the timeline?
Sure. We have the HCBS caps drafted, and we're going to be doing testing in the next year. Well, actually, we're going to do several rounds of testing. So I'd say the next 3 years we'll be doing testing. The same with the care tool. What we have to do is really take a look at where we need modifications, and then we'll be testing that. And Deb and I were talking today about what additional things need to happen for her to finish her work on the administrative measures. Because that, especially for this population, is really important. And I think her work is really very important, needs to be finished.
You have these great demos coming up that might be good places to test.
Absolutely.
So, Adam, go ahead.
Given your comments about the great diversity in the population, the highly individualized nature of care, the notion of creating patient-centered care, it seems to me that, you know, to find measures that cut across everything is very difficult. One thing that sort of unites it, at least for this more disabled population that requires long-term care supports and services, is an individualized care plan.
Yes.
And so I guess my question is, are there measures out there that actually look at the existence and quality of individualized integrated care plans?
Well, in the early days of the deinstitutionalization, I worked in the area of developmental disabilities, and the judges in some of those cases ordered that individuals be followed. And we looked at about 35 different dimensions, outcome dimensions of a person's life, one of which was related to their service plan. So some of that information is there, but again, it's very specific to mostly the developmental disabilities populations. So probably what could come out of that is, I mean, in general sense, people were much better off in the community than they were in the institution. And with pre and post testing, it showed that very clearly. And there are probably very specific characteristics around the plan and how the planning was done. What is that kind of what you were looking at or thinking about?
Cross-cutting potential measures, you know, to assess the quality of an individual care plan.
Yeah.
Complex needs require integration of primary care, long-term care, supportive services, behavioral health intervention, you know, integrated individualized care plans.
Wow. Yeah.
I would account for the diversity of the population, the highly individualized nature of the planning, of the member-centric variety.
Wow, that would be very interesting to demonstrate with the duals population. I think that's a great idea. Cheryl.
Rita? I think this is a wonderful, frontier here that you're engaged in, and I find some of your challenges daunting. But I guess, take exception to one of the things you said, or perhaps I'd say it's on a continuum. And so you mentioned, and I think it's true, that perhaps in the future some of the care coordination might not need to be an individual. And I think for some, I think that's true. You know, if I know the doc, if I'm seeing somebody in psychotherapy and I know the doc changed the meds, I can just find that out from an EHR that's shared publicly, and I don't need to necessarily go beyond that. But clearly, with a lot of the complex people that we're talking about that are duals with comorbid, conditions, you really need that multidisciplinary team, again, for the planning. So it's not just, he plans over there, and she plans over there, and I plan here, and we all check in on the EHR once in a while and, you know, see if we're all on the same bus. But I need to learn from him about, you know, the drug she's on, and I need to learn from her about. So, I mean, and I think, actually, some of the biggest challenges right now is identifying who that is.
Yeah.
Because not everybody does need a team.
Yeah.
You know, we have in behavioral health, we have this, we call it a four-quadrant model, where you go low physical health needs, high physical health needs, low behavioral health needs, behavioral health needs. And clearly the ones that are high physical health, high behavioral health need care coordination. But what about, you know, high on one and, you know, high physical health needs, maybe a little tendency toward depression. Mm-hmm. Do they? I'm not sure. And, you know, I think we need to get much better clinically. And then we need to try to measure it, God knows how. But we need to get better at when these systems of coordinated care and team planning really kick in. You know, there's that group that needs it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that makes me think about health homes, for starters. I mean, that's just in the very early days of that. But some people fall across all of the continuums, multiple chronic conditions, multiple functional challenges, behavioral health needs, and long-term services and support needs. And boy, and that's not uncommon with a lot of folks who have disabling and chronic conditions, yeah.
And especially if you try to keep them in the community.
Yeah.
You know, because it's far easier, frankly. My first job as a social worker in 1977 was at a skilled nursing facility. And you could see the people came in and they really had high needs. But you know, a year later, some of those people were up walking around and they were just fine. But you know what? The family had gotten used to having that person there. They'd already cleared out their apartment. They'd already, mom's taken care of. It was a relief to them.
Yeah.
And so they stayed on Medicaid in that nursing home for 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was no longer their needs, but at these critical incidents, if you get into a nursing home,
yeah,
getting them out is sometimes very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll take a couple more comments, and then Sarah and Deb and Susan are going to flesh out a little bit more of the current activities. So this won't shut down the conversation about home and community-based services, but we'll take these next three and then expand the conversation again. So, Jim.
Thanks. Ken, the ER physician, I'm very interested in this idea of sort of a kind of a ready ability to have a composite definition of the stability of a home at any one time. The more dynamic things are instead of static assessments, the more valuable it is to the clinician. And so the idea of, you know, real-time information that sort of informs on all these different domains is obviously the future. Hopefully it is. And whether it's health navigators, you know, that are reporting information, I think that that's just a really essential thing for us to kind of develop. I'm very interested in having paramedics or anybody else that are in these homes hundreds of thousands of times a year to be able to kind of take snapshots of what's going on so people can be informed like that. So I think I'm very much on this page of the social world. And I just mentioned that there is this thing called the Human Services Domain, which is being developed on the National Information Exchange Model. There's a brand new exchange of information that's now being developed by the Administration of Children and Families, who's actually been given ownership. So just like the health information exchange, sharing health information in the real world, there's a brand new whole evolution going on in HHS on the social information world. And this human services domain is just being built, and Hopkins has got the contract to start to develop it. And it's going to be sharing information for HHS services at the state and regional level. And they will be doing the same thing that Homeland Security had difficulty 10 years ago in talking among military and other kind of security operations. Linda Gibbs, who's the Secretary of Health in New York City, came from Homeland Security and said, wow, I see the very same platforms that didn't used to talk to one another that we made talk together over here. We can now make those social worlds speak in the social world. And actually, New York City is the paradigm of this whole thing and starting to share across these platforms that never used to talk to one another. And I think eventually that's going to drill down to the living room. But it's really important to know that, yeah, like, you know, who's on probation doesn't get mixed up with some kid that's, you know, needs foster care.
Yeah.
And those kinds of cross-linking things are actually starting to be built now. We have to kind of keep that in mind. And then tie it to the HIEs, tie it to the health information world. That's all coming.
Is that Hopkins demo, is that national or is that state-specific?
Well, they're just building it. But it's actually, if you look at the NIEM, if you go to the National Information Exchange Model, NIEM, and just look up human services domain, you'll see that this whole thing is just beginning to morph right now.
Okay, the rest of you can leave your cards up, but we are only going to have Tom and Sally speak at this moment and then move on to Sarah.
Thank you. I enjoyed that, your presentation. I think there's a lot of it. It's a kind of futuristic view that really says it takes a village. The whole concept of where we've been going dealing with the dual eligibles or any other frail population, it has focused in on the medical care model, is only dealing with, I think it was Schoenberg in the New England Journal said, 10% of the health impact. Being able to have that accountability for the social institutions to deal with the environment, the safety issues, the ability of the families and institutions to deal with behavioral elements. Rhonda will correct me on that one. And then there's the genetic phase. It's building that whole thing for the future, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. Great. I'm very glad to see us moving into this area with home and community-based services, and I think that there are a lot of challenges. And I just had 2 points, and they both relate to workforce. One is that I'd love to see us figure out a way to get more workforce-related measures in this. I know in one of the structural measures in the GAPS, access to support services and care is included in the breakouts there. The subpoints are appointment availability and transportation readily available. But I think we should also include something about the workforce capacity for home and community-based service workers, because it varies differently, you know, place to place, and it can be difficult to get the data on this. That more than half the states have registries and directories that a consumer can access, but certainly not all of them. So that's, you know, that's one place to think about, and something we could do on the state level to encourage it. Also, the other point is just it's one of semantics, and I'm one of the people who frequently can dismiss questions of semantics as being, you know, extraneous, but I do think it is relevant. Is the term caregiver, because I know we use it to, when we talk about it, we use it to describe both the unpaid workforce and the paid workforce, and it kind of blurs some of the distinctions because it's not always the same there. And I know we want to address everybody, but there are some specific distinctions within the paid workforce. And I also think we really need to kind of keep up with, as Anita was mentioning, the disability rights groups have kind of pushed the whole person-centered concept, you know, further. And if this group really intends to be led by person-centered concepts, I think we need to make sure that the people who are the persons there that are intended are their terms are being used. And for the most part, caregiver is in some circles really considered pejorative, and it's not used as much. But home and community-based based services worker, or LTSS worker, personal care, personal services worker, but emphasizing worker rather than caregiver. So I think it's important from both the workforce issue or angle as well as the consumer angle to think about it. So if we're thinking about paid workforce, I would encourage us to think about term involving worker rather than caregiver.
Thank you. Sarah, zip through your remaining material.
I will be fast. I just wanted to let you all know that Mitra on our staff at the table behind Deb was kind enough to pull from existing work that had already been done at ARC, AARP, and the National Balancing Indicators Contractor. And we've sort of tried to boil down what does exist in home and community-based services measures for you to get a sense of what those measures, state-specific, you know, as they may be, actually look like. So there's a handout in your folder on the left-hand side in the back. Looks like this at the table. And I'll just briefly walk you through the methodology of how we got to this, and then we have some discussion questions that you can continue to go over as a group. So it was informative for this exercise for us to look at the organizing domains that these different scans use, because this is such a different quality paradigm than we're used to working with at MQS especially. So just to draw your attention to the ARC domains, major ones were client functioning, client experience, and program performance, with a range of subdomains under each of those. AARP, which is a little bit more of a structural scorecard across the states, looked at affordability and access, choice of setting and provider, quality of life, quality of care. That one's obviously of interest to this discussion, and support for family caregivers. The National Balancing Indicators are, their domains are sustainability, self-determination and person-centeredness, prevention, community integration and inclusion, shared accountability, coordination, and transparency. So you'll notice that some overlap, some are kind of sticking out, depending on the purpose of these different measurement programs, but they all give us something to think about. So we took all 148 measures identified from these three sources, mapped them to the five high-leverage opportunities that this group has put forward, scored them on relevance levels to the different subgroups within the duals population, cut out some low-relevance measures there, and then looked sort of at the inclusiveness of the survey or tool that the measure comes from, and yielded
a narrowed set of 24 measures, which will give you a flavor of some of the types of available HCDF measures. So you can all take a minute to review that document and then consider these questions. You'll see in the first column the source, the framework, then the domain, subdomain, the specific measure title, and then some of the notes about the populations that the measure is used in. These are not endorsed. There hasn't been a call for measures in this area at NQF to date, but I think Anita emphasized that they really see a need to get more standardization around these, and if this group would like to echo that, we could put that in our report as well.
Are we looking for the ones that seem most relevant to us? Or?
Well, the discussion can go any number of ways. We say, do any of these look particularly promising? What types of domains are ringing true to the experience of the dual eligible beneficiaries? How do you think our framework and our proposed approach relates to these development needs? Those types of issues are all fair game.
And Anita, before we leave, we welcome you to chime in on that this topic as well. If there's anything in this list that you would say,
Sarah,
if there's anything in the list that you would say, holy cow, we better not lose track of this or this or this measure, that would be great.
I'm lost in paper. Can you hold up what it looks like? Okay, thank you.
We'll look for that.
Come to the table for a second.
One of the things that I was mentioning before is that whole notion of access. And that, in the last year, that issue has been playing on my mind so much because I really, it's a very complicated issue. It's not just getting to the doctor's office. There's so many other impediments. And I think being able to understand access for this group would be really important. And I don't think that we've even begun to integrate healthcare with social support. That integration is really lacking. So,
Deb, kind of asked you to comment, and Susan too, if you're still with us. So, Deb, go ahead.
It's difficult to add to everything that's already been said today. From my perspective, I think there's one of the issues that we haven't been able to get at is this connectedness issue, and how do we actually go about measuring that? And I think especially for the population that uses community-based long-term supports and services is important. And so can the primary care physician identify the caregiver, and that could be the professional caregiver or the family caregiver, you know, upon discharge? Does the case manager know that their person was in a hospital and may need to have their care plan adjusted? Does the hospital have a memorandum of understanding with the area disability resource center to coordinate post-discharge services? And those are all things that aren't on this measure list. And I think it's difficult because of the heterogeneity to like pick one out versus the other. So I'm not being very helpful here. I will add to this that the measures that Anita was referring to that Art's been working on were
and I spoke to you all about before, were potentially preventable hospitalizations. And one thing we found after we developed the measures and we had some time to go and back and look at them was the absolutely critical nature to be able to risk adjust for comorbidities. And so I throw that out as an issue that the science needs to move forward on, that especially for these populations.
Thanks. Susan, are you on the phone?
Yes, I've been on. Okay.
Yay. Thank you so much for hanging in there.
I'm not there in person. And hi, Anita. Nice to hear from you as well. You know, the scorecard took about 2.5 years to produce, and it was always designed to be state-based. Deb Potter and probably others in the room, I can't see you, but were involved much in the thinking of developing this scorecard. And the most frustrating thing, which still seems to be coming up in discussions even today, is we still don't have a single measure in community-based quality that could be measured across the state, and probably won't from what I hear for even the next one, which will be in about 2 years. By the way, this was funded also by the Commonwealth Fund and the SCAN Foundation. So it is frustrating that we just can't seem to get even a single measure of home and community-based quality that we could aggregate at the state level and compare across the state level. I mean, the purpose of the scorecard is very much to improve quality across the nation, of course, and that states could really take a good look comparatively of where they are. It's been helpful for states to do that, to really focus in on some areas and improve it according to the vision of a high-performing services and support system. But it is really devoid of any HCBS quality or any measures of integration. We have a complete missing dimension. And so when you have that dimension, long-term services and supports domains, you're missing integration and care coordination, which is still in the vision, but there are not enough data to actually measure it.
Thank you. We have a few comments in the room. I'm going to loop back to Rhonda, who we missed in the last round. Go ahead.
I may be a bit controversial here, so bear with me. One of the things that seems to be missing here, which is a very important point, and that can affect all these measures, is something that Rita said that drew my attention again to previous experience in working with dual eligibles. Because there is a financial construct that dual eligibles are either eligible for their services or not, and such that if they become more functionable, they become less eligible. Mm-hmm. But somehow we're not capturing that in any way, and my concern is that with the set of measures as we're going, the measures would incentivize silently for people to remain disabled, even though there may be a window for advancement in some way. And I'm not clear how to capture that, but I'm just really worried. It may not be in a measure, but it may be in other, incentives or the way things are built. But if we don't pay attention to that, we could create a real big problem here.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Thank you. Jenny.
So, I'd like to pick up on a comment that Alan mentioned, and as I look at all these different measures about having a health and care plan over a life cycle approach to this, once people get identified as having some chronicity issues, and how to do self-care, manage care well, and then as things become more complex, the ability to have a predictable pathway. For example, if you have Parkinson's disease that gets advanced, there's probably a predictable pattern, or in some cases, the range of data that tell us with Alzheimer's progression. Again, not everybody's the same, but if there is a reflection of that, that would then tap on the intervention that would be important for the worker, the caregiver, vis-a-vis the individual's ability to maintain their health, it's more of a composite sense of, you know, of being able to do this over a course of time, because a lot of this is going to be predictable for those of us who have some experience in it. And then the second element that is not here, other than what I see about being able to get your needs met, is something that you brought up about workforce, the ability to have a dependable workforce. And so much of, quote, quality is being able to have a, and I think the disabled community has done very well. They choose to have a certain worker and be able to have that kind of training as well as continuity. And that makes for a lot, because that's, by contrast, in nursing homes, when you have a turnover rate oftentimes of 100% per year, that connotes the anti-quality side versus continuity of care provider who's the direct care workforce, for example, has to be an aspect of a home and community-based system. So I don't see that that's easily captured, because this has only begun in the nursing home environment to start capturing turnover rates. But this is one of those aspects about having community resources planned for you, as well as a predictable workforce. And over here it says if your care manager hears your needs and finds your helps you find resources, the community response side is uneven, because many communities don't have the services that are actually needed to help people stay there. So it's a much more complicated ecosystem that we know is messy, so to speak, in the home and community-based world. But if we're talking about helping people, and my metric is helping people stay as stable as possible and be able to kind of stay in their best steady state, if that's the end point, then what has to go into it in order to produce that?
So you all are looking at this list and finding the even more gaps, but just as a reminder, none of these are on our list right now, right? These are all candidate measures, so we were actually hoping you'd look at the list and discover some that might be useful as opposed to what isn't here. So that's just as a reminder, Steve.
Yeah, I think these are wonderfully complimentary. I'm kind of all over this list. I found seven that I'd like to add. But, you know, I think that there's several that apply to people in need of long-term supports and services that may not require the full, you know, game of the waiver home and community-based services. And so somehow injecting these kinds of domains or scopes into our I'll just quickly, unmet need in ADLs, IDLs is a great one. Sensitive to cultural, ethnic, and linguistic backgrounds, degree of active consumer participation in decisions. These are a lot of the things that we've been looking at. Community, people in the community usually are always getting needed support. Caregiver usually are always getting needed support. And that could be caregiver or worker, I guess. And coordination between home and community-based services and institutional services. That could be ADRC services, and that kind of coordination, you know, we so often just look at coordination with the primary care or the physician services, but this is so key to coordinate with the case manager or what have you in the community. And then the last one I sort of checked was, boy, the waiver wait list. I mean, that's one that all states have to track already, right? And it would seem like the proportion of people who qualify that are on the wait list relative to your state's need would be a huge quality issue.
That one's a little fussy, because yeah, some states let anybody sit on the wait list whether they qualify for services or not, and other states you have to qualify to get on the wait list. So it's a little apples and oranges, but it's still really important to know if there's a pent-up demand, you know, it reflects some amount of pent-up demand. Cheryl, I think you were next.
I just wanted to second that. There were quite a few. It was actually a high number of overlapping with those that were mentioned that I very much would support. There are a few that they sound great, but I'd like to get a little bit more information about, because I'm not quite sure if it gets there. But even
I think that tremendously, especially, I mean, the one that leapt out at me, and I went back and looked at the others, but the one that leapt out at me was the degree of active participation in decisions concerning treatment. I think that hits on a lot of areas that we're interested in. But I agree, I think there are quite a few here that would certainly complement the others that we have chosen.
Thanks. I'll just go in order since I didn't see how you put things up. So, Jim is next.
I'm feeling the same way. I feel like this is what I've been waiting for in this committee. It's like we're talking about the things that are the missing links here. And I think that really maybe what Adam talked about earlier was, you know, an individualized care plan. There's a social care plan. These are the component parts that we need. We need to build probably something. I'm not sure I could pick any one of these and say individually, but in a composite, this is the type of a program I feel like we need to, I mean, the type of an assessment tool that has to be created that contains these elements. Maybe not everyone is completely germane to everybody, but this is really the social world that we're really trying to measure here for the first time out.
Thanks. Rita?
I always, when I look at lists like this, I think of my mother and, you know, who would always be polite and, you know, would always try to give you the right question. So if you'd ask her if she was treated respectfully, she would always say yes, you know. She'd never complain. I don't know how you deal with those people. But I guess one tactic is being more specific in what you ask. And this is a great list. On some of the ones around life satisfaction, so I think of the depression screening question where you ask somebody, you know, do you have an event, a regular event that you enjoy? Did you do something in the last week that you enjoyed? And what was it? And it's just kind of a measure of are they still enjoying their life? And I think that might be an important question to ask this group. It's used as a measure of depression because depressed people stop enjoying their life. But it's just a thought.
Thanks. My aunt will balance out your mother.
They'll get a median answer in there somewhere. Adam.
No, I agree. I like the things on this list. I think they align very well with things that we've been talking about for months. Just to refer back to Anita's domains, and I think the ones I noted were control, access, community, and coordination, right? So there are measures here of control, degree of consumer participation in decisions concerning treatment. There's one about availability of self-direction options, so you have control. We talked about access, and access is not just being able to get to your doctor's appointment, but the second one is about availability of support with everyday activities. That's, you know, the true meaning of access to someone who's disabled. There are measures which touch on community and access to relationships. So, you know, I think there's some really strong things here, but I think also someone pointed out what's not here is the coordination part. You know, coordination, especially between the home and community-based service world, the long-term care and supports world, and the other worlds with which it needs to coordinate. But I like it.
Great. Jenny? Tom?
When I put on my stethoscope and I'm being an internist and I think of my dual eligibles, the ones that I like are satisfaction with close friends and relationships with family. Those are the ones that, at least in my anecdotal experience, are lacking in people who have significant problems. But when I put on my health plan hat and I deal in a world of claims data, I start saying, okay, I'm not going to get a claim on any of these things, so where is the data going to come from? It's going to be like a CAHPS survey. So who's accountable then? It's not really an accountability, it's an identification of the individual. So I'm still struggling with just how we would use these, although I like them.
Yeah, I was like going back to our, you know, the talk that kicked us off this morning and thinking about the shared accountability and the we're all in this village together kind of model. So if we have people suffering, living alone, and in need of help, you know, maybe there's a little accountability to go around, you know, for a lot of different folks. Are we ready for you to kind of, now that we've looked at these gaps, to loop back around to the gaps that we left off? And we're not doing too bad, really, on time, you guys. Very good discussion.
So bear with me as I page back through a lot of slides. If you recall our earlier conversation about the core measure set, we wanted to take a look at the set as a whole. Sorry, I can't talk into this. To review the measures in the core set, first for potential unintended consequences. Trish has repeatedly used the example of observation status as something you might also want to measure in concert with a readmissions measure or a length of stay measure, so that you're not pushing the system around in inappropriate ways or encouraging any type of gaming. Other ideas for potential unintended consequences are on the slide. So I would suggest that you kind of pull your measure handout back out, skim this list, and think about unintended consequences of the measures which we would want to note in our recommendations.
Pardon the interruption. This is the operator. We're not hearing any audio.
Everyone is thinking very deeply.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you for checking. Crosswalk, sorry. Potential unintended consequences to the measures? The Excel version of the potential dual core measures, yeah, the larger list.
So, and I'm noticing my brain immediately going to modifications, but we're not going to do modifications right this minute, right?
Correct.
We're going to we'll come to modifications in a second. So, mainly we're just looking at, undue burden of reporting or analysis. Lord have mercy.
Rita, go ahead and get us started.
Well, I'm on the SAMHSA team that actually consults with the states around their Medicaid health home. So I got stuck on that page, and the medical home. And one of the things I always ask them, how do you identify clients to become eligible for the health homes? But then I always ask, and what's the path out of the health home? Because people do get better. And, you know, that 5% is really sick, and some die, but some of those 5% get well, you know, and we focus on them as if they're static. So there's
there's a way into these services, but just because you trigger one time, they need to be used at intervals so that, you know, when they don't need that level of care management or whatever, that they, you know, that we don't spend resources there and they don't need them.
The one that I'm struggling with in terms of the undue burden of reporting is that is on medical home. All the states that are getting their state plan amendments to do a health home approach are using a, you know, state-specific unique way of qualifying providers to be health homes in their state. And so there's not that much overlap with these medical home standards and the health home approaches that states are starting to roll out. So that's where I would see the undue burden of reporting is these multiple ways of providers having to qualify either with the state.
Although I would say, and I'm not CMS, and maybe someone from CMS would know, I think ultimately they are going to move that program to a more standardized measure set, aren't they, Karen?
Steve, is your sign still up to talk?
I think the obvious one of just, you know, plans or systems avoiding taking on accountable care for those who are going to decline inevitably, almost, you know, that really high risk, expensive, those who would decline anyway are the most frail. There's certainly an issue with some of the quality of life measures. The one that I've mentioned in the past in terms of around the care coordination and even hospital transitions to home, you know, if a system just sets up a SWAT team that does a 2 to 4 week transition with and then just moves on to the next person, you know, to check the boxes, okay, we got med rec, we got, you know, a phone call, we got PCP visit scheduled, but there's no real relationship or longitudinal care coordination, I think we sort of get into this stopgap of adding potentially yet another potential silo that now we've got added a transition. You got to go from hospital transition team from transition team to primary care rather than some enhancement of the hospital and the primary care ends of things.
Thanks. Leonardo.
Yeah, I guess for me, what Steve just mentioned what I guess is a negative impact on access to services. The adverse selection issue, I think, is the number one thing that I spend time thinking about. Other ones that occur to me are just ways in which the measure set then sort of is formative as to how we think about things. So one is, does it deepen disparities? Do we sort of, in the measure set, repeat the bias towards the bias view that led to disparities in the first place? So that's something that worries me. I mean, I'm a big fan of programs that are going to redesign delivery of care, but I worry that the redesign of delivery of care will be done in a way that really favors certain neighborhoods, it disfavors rural areas that are poor or urban areas that are poor. So I think that that's one concern I have. And then I think also just, you know, the thing we're struggling with, the fact that clinical things lend themselves to measurement. Will that become a bias that makes us, you know, not really focus enough on function, not really focus enough on a bunch of things that are just harder to measure clinically? So does going to a measurement regime really sort of start to affect the way we think about these programs? I mean, I wouldn't want to design programs to the measurement. And I think that that is an unintended consequence that happens. And then there are a few of them that I would add that are less about the, it's not really about the measurement, it's about what the programs are trying to do. And so, like, integrated programs for duals, I think themselves have a lot of risks for unintended consequences that I would want these measures to sort of try to address.
Thanks.
that last one, I would have to think more about examples. But
thanks. Tom?
An unintended consequence is inherent in everything that we do that's based upon on science is the evolution of that science. So, for instance, with the BMI screening, there's movements away from the use of BMI, but by memorializing BMI in a measure, then that perpetuates it. And so all the young, hulky characters with high BMIs who are really much healthier than me would fall out.
Michelle?
I think I just want to make sure that we're focusing on what's really important with the programs and just step back and think about accessing health care or, better yet, meeting a dual eligible's needs is what's really important, and to make sure that what the measure set is measuring is that. I think it's easy to fall into the trap of the clinical stuff is easier to measure, so let's measure more of that. But I think then that continues almost that bias of that is healthcare, and I would hate for this group to end up perpetuating that concept. And I think we really have an opportunity to break away from it. My personal mission right now at CMS is to get away from patient-centered care to person-centered care. I think just that changing in wording helps people think beyond a clinical lab test or something. You know, it really gets to this is the person and what are their care needs. So I would want us to be very thoughtful about that. You know, is this really essential for what we're trying to get at versus nice to know or easily measured? And then there's also just reminding that this, I think it's fun and interesting to think about the dual demonstrations, but likely that's 1 to 2 million people. The dual eligibles are a 9 million or so group. So these measures are for all of the dual eligibles, and I think it's easy also to start narrowing and thinking really on how this will this work in the dual demos. And I think we can use the dual demos to test a lot of things and maybe find out what does work well or to help support some other initiatives. But just to pull back, I always tend to dive in, and it takes a little time for me to pull back and think of the larger picture and make sure that we're focusing on the full picture.
Thank you. With that, Sarah, do you want to move to your next to last?
All right. Next piece of paper is this one. It's orange. It says measure gaps and modifications for consideration at the top. We have two-part instructions. The first is the slide about measure modifications. These are modifications you have previously raised, and we were able to get them out of the transcript or meeting notes and documented them here as they relate to measures that are in the core set right now. Because this is pretty nuanced to consider modifications to data source, population, numerator, denominator statements, et cetera, pretty much any of the fields in the spreadsheet would be fair game. That's going to be your homework for after the meeting. I'm sorry. Happy Fat Tuesday. So right now, we'd like to spend some time talking about gap areas. Again, the left-hand side of the page lists gaps that have previously come up in discussion. And we've heard more today already, but we'd like to give you a little bit of brainstorming time. The staff will put some things up on the flip charts. And if we can flesh out these gap areas as much as possible, we'll be able to prioritize them tomorrow and give that extra layer of specificity to HHS in the recommendations. So take a minute, and then we'll start getting your ideas flowing about more detailed measure gap areas.
So I just need to point out from my own, like, need to take a walk before the sun's rest that a lot of the things that we talked about today are already here. So you don't have to come up again with the things that we've already addressed. So we've talked a lot about medication management. That's already on the list. Person-centered planning, transportation, and other ways to access services, informed decision-making. So many of the things that we have mentioned are here. So don't rack your brains needing to come up with more gaps. We have plenty. It's my message to you as a person who needs to get some exercise so I don't end up in a wheelchair in a nursing home when I'm 57 years old. So, did I scare you? No, you won't come up with any. Tomorrow we're going to prioritize them. Just kind of scan down the list and say,
I know you get to add. If there are guest concepts that we haven't represented in the list, please shout those out, and we'll just get a record of everything so we have a complete environment to work on.
Bravely shout them out, Steve.
I just want to add the screening for health literacy and cognitive impairment. Those two, bring those back up. They inordinately, you know, or disproportionately affect dual eligibles and have a huge impact on care.
And I would reiterate what I said before, but just in case you weren't clear, that was a recommendation for this measure gaps as well, that under structural measures, access to support services and care, should have a sub-bullet about workforce capacity, some measurement there.
On screening and assessment, there are a few things about medication use, but I would like just to add the words appropriate prescribing.
Radical.
I don't know if it's included in the structural system structures to assure connection, but I just want to make sure that there's something that is measuring the blending of the resources and the funding in some way.
Did you capture that? Oh, Glenda, say that again.
Yeah, just want to make sure in the system structure to assure connection that there is some subdomain that's looking at the blending of resources and funding streams. Got it? Okay.
Cheryl?
I just wanted to get back to what Rita had mentioned before, that sort of life enjoyment aspect, or have you done something enjoyable or fun? You consider fun in the last week. Something like that that really, I think, gets at a lot of things.
Thanks. Oh, Jenny?
It goes back to the structural aspect. When it says coordination between systems of payment, it might be also harmonization of programs such as hospice, such as that happen to appear in two systems. Basically, complaints even. They're different in the Medicare and the Medicaid system. So these are structural harmonization.
Thanks. Sometimes call it alignment. That's the other thing we're trying to do in Medicare and Medicaid is align the rules. Samantha?
I think this falls under structural, but it touches upon two topics that people raised earlier. The first is kind of changing eligibility, perhaps under access to support services and care. I'm not sure. But this idea that if you meet an institutional level of care, you get services in the community, but if those services are so great that you get better, but that then you don't meet that level of care, where are you? And then also this idea of kind of capturing the human service data through HIT and through an EHR, not necessarily just a PHR.
Are you good, scribes? You've got those? Okay. Steve. Oh, sorry. Steve, go ahead. Rhonda.
I just want to add to the life enjoyment, you might want to put health psychology by that. And Seligman is probably the granddaddy of that, because there's a whole domain of measures that have been designed for that.
Okay.
Under peer coordination is coordinating with the long-term services and supports.
Rita?
This is probably my slow brain, but what is self-efficacy?
It's like a measure of control. Tell me if I'm wrong. It's like, how much control do I have over my choices? And
at first I looked down and thought self-efficiency, and I thought, well, I'll flunk on that one, but no.
Take care.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Does choice of caregiver fall under self-efficacy, or are you saying should it? Let's call it out on the list. That makes sense. Quality of life. Tom?
I think there's a real gap in terms of assessment of community service integration. And I'm leaving this as a community measure as opposed to an individual one.
Well,
yeah, I think probably, although you, ideally you'd have like to process. But I mean, heck, how many, you read Money Magazine and it tells you these are the safest cities or these are the safe cities that have got this, that, or the other attributes. There are those communities that are, well, are efficient, that are able to provide support services, and there are those where people are completely lost. And I'll bet we find differences in health outcomes.
Susan or other folks on the phone, do you have any things to add while we're going around?
No, I think everyone's doing fine.
Okay. Steve, are you done? Okay. All right. Thank you. Good list. And as Sarah said, we'll revisit these tomorrow if we don't feel like, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you go, oh, there was just that one other one in my encouragement of moving outdoors. I made you jump over it. So, Sarah, is that it for you? And now we're... Okay. All right. Dan. We're on the home stretch here.
All right. At first, I thought I could do this in one slide, but there's no way. I'll start with that. But I'll go through this pretty quickly because it's basically recapping the themes that we were hearing throughout the day. I will say that many people in the room were taking very detailed notes, so if you don't see your specific comment, it was captured. It just wasn't... I wanted to keep this as short as possible. So when we talk generally... their overall, there was an assurance we need to, one of the things was to make sure that the measures sufficiently address connectedness, and that came up many times during the day across all areas, addressing both appropriate services and then also how the funding structures affect that. Also the notion of person-centered and not just about the healthcare services. And in that notion, thinking about the impact of health literacy, functional capacity, quality of life. And then, again, shared accountability came up several times during the day, thinking about how to be aware of the shared accountability across various entities and then take approaches that even if you don't have the coordination now, it will motivate greater coordination and alignment over time. And really thinking about, let's stay focused on what those high priority areas are for the duals population that we've talked about, frankly, through the last year or so.
And then when we talked about the state's role and engagement in terms of what's happening at the state level, acknowledgement of the variation in existing structures and then the related gaps and the continuity disruptions and related to that gaps in data, and then frankly the impact of the payment policy, the degree to which states pay attention to care that is covered under Medicare. And given that we're thinking about both programs, we really need to make sure that that consideration is looking at both. The group threw out a number of ideas, for example, coming up with shared savings that really benefit both programs, looking how to address data access barriers, and then also looking at ways to use current access to data in order to start to benchmark across states, audits as a way to look at how states are using data, and when the measure concepts are being developed to make sure those get submitted to NQF so that they can be considered in the endorsement process. Then as you all considered the core measure set, really the focus of that was about let's focus on what's important, what's missing, and what exists but isn't quite right, and some of the general challenges, the types of general challenges that were identified by this group is, you know, is it really more important to create a list that's short or a list that's right? Especially right now, given that the duals work, the core set spans across many federal programs. Also, the challenge around is it better to look at a composite measure, meaning it's a suggested measure concept that adds many settings, or to add measures for different settings? And this was came up in discussions about the transition records measures. And then another type of challenge that came up was considering measures from the individual's perspective, and are the measures, will they give incentives to result in care that's consistent with the patient's preference, for example, the quality of life issues. And then there were a number of observations that you can see listed here regarding the different reference periods for Medicare and Medicaid caps, for the health plan caps, the versions are different, pain management and how that's really needed in settings beyond just hospice, polypharmacy and other medication issues, and reconciliation going beyond just reconciliation, but also considering are the prescriptions actually appropriate. Readmissions, how that's a high priority area, and really exemplifies the need for addressing connectedness and making sure that we do address the observation status issue and the impact on comorbidity to readmissions. And then in the discussion about unintended consequences, some examples that came out of this group, adverse selection, that how do you transition out of certain settings of care, the measurement burden, and yet not letting that stop the focus on what does the person need. Don't let that be an excuse. And then also one of those, if we're using measures that might become outdated because the science has evolved. Those are just some examples of some of the themes out of the discussion on unintended consequences about the core measure set. And then looking at the Medicaid adult core set, the considerations that went into narrowing that set had to do with measurement burden, the data gaps at the state level. Even still, the 26 measures include some reach measures in order to motivate the states to keep evolving. And some of the issues that we've talked about in terms of caps and really understanding the patient experience, fortunately, there's those supplemental questions that are being added for Medicaid around care coordination, shared decision-making, care transitions, and that there is some funding to develop measures to address gaps in the core set based on what states can do, and that 2012 is really a year to be working with states to understand these issues and provide technical assistance. In terms of observations from this group around that discussion, it's what came out strongly in the themes was it's really important to sync measures across these core lists. We've got to look at both. They really need to, they can't be separate. It's important also to assess over time when somebody goes from being just on Medicaid to being dual eligible and whether the outcomes have changed, whether they stay the same, they get better, they worsen. And it's also important to make the best use of available data to start to show state comparisons that came out earlier as a theme as well. In terms of the discussion around disparities and stratification, while it was recognized that there are definitions of race and ethnicity, there seemed to be an interest in making sure that they're used in a standardized way. Also, in looking at stratification, this group seemed to be very clear on interest in stratifying both by dual status, so you can separate out the dual eligible population from the rest of the population, but also stratification within the duals population in order to support the different quality improvement strategies depending on what the subset of the duals population is you're talking about. In terms of the themes around the discussion around the Humana data, excellent starting point to tease out questions. And some of the questions that came up were, for example, about the super users, what's driving the 1% to generate 13% of the cost, and where and how is our public sources of data, for example, the ambulance data, how is that being factored into understanding all of this? And then also, what might the data show regarding mental health and length of stay and some of the areas where it was not appearing in the Humana data, at least for this first go-round. Then talking about home and community-based services, I believe this is the last slide, I promise. I don't want to stand between Alice and the sunshine. I'm out here from the Pacific Northwest. I know what it's like. So in terms of gaps in home and community-based services, it's a really stark, practical reminder that the system for HCBS, it's really state-specific, and there's very little standardization. And everything in home and community-based services pretty much starts with the person's individual needs, and that patient autonomy not only is clear in this set of services, but also is becoming more and more of a theme and something that we're all going to be dealing with even more in the more traditional healthcare settings. Home and community-based services are testing both CAPS and the Care Functional Assessment Tool, which is a good step forward. But there's really a need for more individually based measures, and then again raising the issue of shared accountability. And it's going to be an interesting process to figure out how to have shared accountability really work with home and community based services. Some of the observations that came from the discussion is that individualized care plans are really core, not only in HCBS, but that's an area where learning can happen in terms of healthcare measurement. And we need to look into the National Health Information Exchange to look at what's going on with the social and human services domain development in order to connect with the healthcare information exchange work. And that could, given how data seems to be an underlying issue with all of this, that's an area we need to understand more fully. We need to address workforce capacity and dependability for both paid and unpaid workers, noting the semantics. And then also looking at the priority gaps. As you all were talking, some of the themes that came out were really important to assess what are the impediments to access to care and home and community-based services, and looking at where the places are where there can be that connectedness. Again, that theme came out several times during the day, a connectedness between home and community-based services and healthcare. And looking at the programmatic issues regarding the financial construct that can undermine, that can not only separate where attention is paid, but frankly undermine the motivation for improvement. If you get better, you lose your coverage. I mean, that's just one example, and that came out as a theme in many ways throughout the day. And then also, again, where's the data to be able to measure the areas that are being discussed. Overall, as you all talked about the concepts on the gap list, I'd say if I had to pick one theme, it seemed generally people were very supportive of approaching those gaps. And so while people had certain favorites, overall the gaps list seemed to be strongly supported. So that's my quick and dirty assessment of the themes of the day. Again, if you don't see your specific comment, it is captured by several people in the room who took much more detailed notes.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Sarah is going to give us our parting assignments.
The scary part is that those were in our handouts, actually, that I got last
month. Oh, they were not. But if anybody would like a copy, because I know that there have been other meetings where people have wanted, yeah, we can certainly send this out.
So, as I said earlier, we'd like you to consider the measure modifications on the orange handout. If you want to write your comments down, that would probably be the easiest way to get them to the staff rather than taking a lot of group time to go through those in detail. It could get a little bit tedious. So, if
you're one of the people in this room that really likes to dive in to tables like this, please do. I think everyone would appreciate the benefit of that detail. Tomorrow, we're going to be doing a lot of work around ideas for measure gap filling. And so that can be a part of what you consider as you look at the measure list. And at the end of the day, we'll ask you to give some closing thoughts about how you would like to see this work used or major messages you'd like to send through the final report. So you can give some big picture reflections as well. And I think that's everything. Please enjoy the sunshine while it lasts, and we will see you tomorrow.
Can we leave our stuff here?
You may leave your papers in the room. I wouldn't leave anything too much more valuable than that. Thanks, everybody.